Good evening. Time being 5:30, I will welcome everyone. My name is Paula Eat. I'm the Mayor of Kingborough, and it's my pleasure to welcome everyone here to tonight's council meeting on Monday, the 25th of October. Welcome to those in the public gallery and also to the people who are watching along at home via YouTube. Being 5:30, I now declare the meeting open. I wish to advise that council meetings are recorded and made publicly available on our website. In accordance with council's policy, I'll ask the Acting General Manager to confirm that the audio recording has commenced.
Yes.
Thank you. I wish to acknowledge the traditional custodians of this land, pay respect to elders past and present, and acknowledge today's Aboriginal community. Our attendees tonight are myself, Councillor Reet, Deputy Mayor Councillor Westwood, Councillor Bastone, Councillor Cordova, Councillor Fox, Councillor Gladewright, Councillor Midgley, Councillor Street and Councillor Wass. From our staff this evening we have the Acting General Manager Dr Stevenson, the Chief Financial Officer Mr Breen, the Director of Engineering Services Mr Reeve, the Director of Governance, Recreation and Property Services Mr Smee, the Manager of Development Services Ms Tyler Moore, Senior Planning Officer Mr Donovan, Media and Communications Advisor Ms Adams and the Executive Assistant Mrs Morton. And we have apologies this evening from Councillor Grace. Moving to page one and the confirmation of minutes, the motion is that the minutes of the open session of Council meeting number 20 held on the 4th of October 2021 be confirmed as a true record. Do I have a mover? Councillor Fox, a seconder, and Councillor Bastone. All those in favour?
Aye.
Against? Motion is carried unanimously. Staying on page one, workshops held since the last council meeting. We had a workshop on the 11th of October, and that was in relation to the complaints handling framework. Moving now to page two, declarations of interest. Does any councillor have an interest that they would like to declare? No? Thank you. Also on page two, transfer of agenda items. Are there any items on the agenda that a councillor would like to transfer from open into closed session or closed into open? No? Thank you very much. Questions without notice from the public. Does any member of the public have a question on notice? Thank you. If you'd like to come up to the lectern, and if you could state your name and address, please, before you start your question.
Thank you, ma'am. Peter Alexis, 33, Taruna Crescent, Taruna. I only discovered 4 hours ago that there are some objections to the planned seating at Taruna Park, and I've sent Mayor Reet an email which provides more detail that I'd like brought to the attention of councillors. I have three questions regarding the seating that this started back in last December, by the way, and you have pretty well installed the foundations for all the seats. But I understand that there's been a sort of whip up of furor amongst a handful of people, and considering that thousands of people use this park each year, I'd like to ask on notice if is Taruna Park the private domain of some of the residents that overlook it? My other next question is, would council contemplate banning people from congregating, chatting and looking at houses at closer range than the proposed seating while their dogs run around? And the third question is, or the third item is, the entire point of the original proposal was to provide staged resting places for the elderly and frail. How does council propose to provide this, particularly at the top of the hill and along the straight, parallel to Taruna Crescent, if there are to be any changes to the seating arrangement that's already commenced. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Alexis. And thank you for those questions. And I did receive your email, and I think Mr. Smee phoned you this afternoon because I was unavailable in meetings. But just to let you know, we certainly have every intention to continue on with installing the seating, and there's, I think, 12 seats in total that will be around the park. You are correct in that there have been some representations from people who live in adjacent houses who are concerned about their privacy and the direction of two of the 12 seats, I beg your pardon. So last week before, I've just a total time warp. So the Deputy Mayor and I actually went and had a look on site last week or the week before, after the footings had been, the holes for the footings had been dug, to see what was intended in terms of the location of the seats. We're certainly very committed to still making sure that there are seats at the top of that hill. I, now having walked it and walked it in heels, inappropriate heels, we can verify that it is quite a steep hill, and there will certainly be some seats there. But we're trying to respond to the concerns of privacy from residents along there and seeing if we can orient the seats slightly so that they're not looking directly into the backyards. So please be assured those seats will be going ahead, but it's just a question of whether there's a compromised position as to where we can place them. And they'll still be spaced out so that there's a resting area. So they would be in that general vicinity of where the footings have been dug for those two. So the work will continue. We're going to start the installation because the concrete has gone in now for those footings, and they'll start at the top end near the dog exercise area and move back down. So those two will be the last ones to be done. And the reason for that is our urban design planner was away all of last week, and so we weren't able to progress that. But certainly I don't believe that we have the powers under any of our bylaws to stop people congregating in areas where they might then look into the neighbouring houses. So that's why we're trying to find that compromise of reorienting. But there is certainly, there's a lot of support for the seats. There's just those concerns from those residents, which I totally understand. But please let me assure you that we will make sure that we get them in. Yeah. They will go in. Yeah. All right. Thank you. Of course. Thank you, Mr. Alexis. Are there any other questions from... Please come up and ask your question.
You want me to say that again?
No, we heard that.
Okay,
just your
good,
name
good.
And name.
My name's Diane Guest. Do you need where I live?
Just the suburb.
Kingston. Right, okay. This is my first, so be patient with me. I live in Kingston at Believer Place, right? And Believer Place, Kanama and Katandra Crescent, around in that area, with number three, they are putting wastes in people's rubbish bins. That's recycle, rubbish and green. And we don't know our rights because some people in the neighbourhood have been given a Red Cross or whatever it is to say it's overweight. And I spoke to the rubbish collector man, who was a delightful chap. I'll give him full credit in what he did. There was yellow bags near my driveway, and I said to him, I know you can't pick them up, but this is really bad because if I drive, I'm going to run over them. And I said, I don't know what's in the rubbish bags. And I said, if it goes all over the street, that's no good either. And I said to him, what do I do? And he said, well, come to the council and just tell them. And he said, they have people that come around and check people's bins. And he said, I'm only a contractor, but sure, that's the best advice I can give you.
Okay.
So the poor darling, he got out of that bin, out of his truck, and picked up those yellow rubbish bags and
lovely,
put them in the truck. God bless him.
So your question is whether we can stop people putting rubbish in other people's rubbish bins?
Yes, around in the suburb.
I believe that the short answer to that is unfortunately no. We don't have any power to stop that. I know sometimes I live in a cul-de-sac and I know sometimes it happens, but we all ask each other because we know each other. But Mr. Reeve, who's our Director of Engineering Services, he might be able to give you some more information about that. Mr. Reeve.
Through you, Mayor. That's correct. I mean, we can't actually police necessarily what goes into or other people putting things into bins. However, what we can do, and it sounds like there's a little bit more to it than just one or two occasions, it sounds like it's been happening on a more regular occasion. What we can do is maybe do some more monitoring of that particular area, if you like. So we can certainly get information back off the drivers there in terms of what they're seeing that area there, because one of the issues we will have is if the residents actually do get a sticker on there to say that they've got an overweight bin or an overfull bin, and it's not their fault, but generally we will actually be sending out a letter to them to actually make them aware of that. So if that continues on, then we want to actually get to the root cause of the problem as compared to sending the letter to the resident, obviously. So I'm happy to actually take on board what you're actually saying there and have a look at that and actually do some monitoring of that area there and see if we can actually maybe try and get to a point where that's not actually happening.
And see, we put the bin, or I have, in the morning and just hope to glory I catch the bin man, you know, so my rubbish or our rubbish in the neighbourhood will go.
All right, lovely. Well, okay. Mr. Reeve will look into that. Thank you.
Okay, well, thank you. Are we allowed to leave?
You can leave, of course. We don't make you stay here. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Well, it was a pleasure talking to all of you.
Thank you, Mrs. Guest. Okay, any further questions from members of the gallery? No? Moving on then to questions on notice from the public. At the time the agenda was compiled, there were no questions without notice from the public, but if any members of the public who are watching do wish to submit a question, they can send it to kc@kingborough.towns.gov.au. Questions without notice from councillors. Does any councillor have a question without notice? Councillor Bastone.
I have a question without notice for closed session, please.
Thank you. Any further questions without notice from councillors? I think I've never heard you all this quiet. Thank you. Moving on, still on page two, we had quite a number of questions on notice from councillors from the last meeting. The first one is a question from Councillor Midgley and an officer's response from Dr. Stevenson in relation to quick response grants. A further question from Councillor Midgley in relation to the Margate to Huntingfield feasibility study and an officer's response from Mr. Reeve. We had another question from Councillor Midgley in relation to Transform Kingston project and an officer's response from Mr. Smee. We had another question from Councillor Midgley in relation to the school waste education program and an officer's response from Mr. Reeve. A question from Councillor Gladewright in relation to youth events with an officer's response from Dr. Stevenson. A question from Councillor Wass in relation to 21 Dens Lane and an officer's response from Ms. Tyler Moore. And a further question from Councillor Midgley in relation to electric vehicle charging stations with an officer's response from Mr. Smee. With that, the open session of Council adjourns and the Planning Authority commences at 5:45 p.m. Turning now to page 5, officers' reports to the Planning Authority. We're considering DAS 26-2020 development application for the subdivision creating 218 residential lots, one commercial lot, 13 road lots, public open space and associated infrastructure works, including sewer pump stations, stormwater and road works. There is a recommendation on page 63. It has 30 conditions in the recommendation. Do I have a mover and a seconder for this, please? Okay, we do need a mover and a seconder, or it'll go under officers' delegation. I'm sure you don't want that to happen. Thank you, moved Councillor Wass and seconded Councillor Midgley. Councillor Wass.
Thank you, Mayor. I've got a few things marked in colour going through it, but I don't know where they are, and it was such a long report that I won't worry too much about it. The first thing I'd like to start out with is that I'm disappointed that the departments within government don't talk to each other, and that's clearly evident from this report that Parks and Wildlife don't seem to want to talk with Department of Communities, who don't want to talk to the Department of State Growth, which surprises me, and I think we've probably could have had a better development application if those departments had spoken to each other. But having said that, look, I know there have been a number of anxious people within our community over a large period of time waiting for this to come. Perhaps it all hasn't gone the way people were predicting, and of course not getting the information, reluctance by communities, Department of Communities, to want to talk to people about it certainly hasn't helped their case. Having said that, the people who put in representations with very meaningful questions and comments, I believe, have, to my way of belief, have been answered by our planners. I don't believe that there is a reason or reasons why this development application is not approved. I am concerned about one thing, and that was the non-provision of 2-foot paths in the streets. But of course council can overcome that by not taking over those roads, I think it was, from my memories. I'm going through here trying to look at the various notes that I made. And I think that's probably all I really want to say, Mayor, at this stage, and I'll sum up if necessary. Thank you.
Thank you, Councillor Wass. Further speakers? I've not heard you all. So quiet. What's happened? Councillor Cordova and then Councillor Gladerat.
Thank you, Mayor. I'll start with a couple of questions. First question is, according to this development application, there is over 14% public open space land dedication in this stage one. By way of comparison, what proportion of public open space was made available in subdivisions of a similar size, whether that's Spring Farm, Whitewater, Kingston Park or Kingston Green? So what's the comparison to those other ones of 14%?
Ms. Tullamore.
Through you, Mayor, we don't have that information on hand to give you an accurate answer. We can provide it afterwards, but it's probably worth noting it's not relevant to the decision-making for this application.
Thanks very much. It would have been interesting to know, just where it sits. Aboriginal Heritage Tasmania and the Department of Communities have been involved in this process as outlined at 2.6.2 on page 61 of the report, and I'll quote, The cumulative result of these investigations was the identification and mapping of an extensive stone quarry and associated artefact scatter site across the southern and eastern portion of the property in proximity to both Coffee Creek and its unnamed tributary. This site is considered a significant part of the complex of Sill Creek quarries within North West Bay. So my question through you, Mayor, is Can we please hear an outline of what the process is from here to protect the stone quarry and artefact scatter site, and to what extent have local First Nations peoples and First Nations organisations been involved in the process?
Ms. Tullamore.
Through you, Mayor, as councillors may be aware, the planning assessments don't have jurisdiction over the Aboriginal artefacts and the relevant acts and regulations around that. The developer will need to work directly with Aboriginal Tasmania to find out what their restrictions are. They will be required to apply for a permit because if they don't have a permit that's currently valid, and it'll stipulate in there what the responsibilities are. It's also not an obligation for us to notify or communicate with the Aboriginal communities. However, in this instance, it was raised on the outside of the application, but it really is dealt with directly through them, and they have enforcement abilities if they do not comply with the requirements issued under their permit.
Thank you. And so, following on from that, will council be playing a role in any way in this space, like in terms of if the permission is granted for the proposal to go through tonight, to what extent does council have any jurisdiction or oversight or management or involvement over the life of the development with respect to Aboriginal heritage?
Ms. Tullamore.
Through you, Mayor, there's nothing under the permit process for that. The only way that we would potentially be involved is if the artefacts or the sites occur in the areas that council will have to take responsibility for, and it would be responsibility of the new owner, being council, to ensure that there is no breach of any approvals that have been given and deal with any other requirements of ongoing requirements of those permits by Aboriginal Tasmania.
Okay, thank you. And then regarding stormwater, the council stormwater system is not yet in place for parts of the Huntingfield estate. Can I please have it explained what the process is from here to ensure that stormwater is managed appropriately, including water sensitive urban design principles? So to clarify the question, how will stormwater management be assessed and enforced for the life of the development and at whose cost?
Ms. Tullamore. Oh, Mr. Donovan.
Welcome.
That's on now, thank you. Thanks for the welcome. In relation to stormwater, you're correct. The report says there isn't any there, obviously. But they'll be required to construct stormwater to our standards under our code. It will connect, it'll probably be its own system, by the way. It's going to drain down Coffee Creek and its tributaries, and it will create its own complete system. And once that's finished to our standards, we'll take it over as we normally would do and run it as our asset. So it'll probably survive on its own under its own system, yeah.
Great, thank you very much. If I may start my substantive, Mayor, the proposed Huntingfield development, subject of the State Government's Huntingfield Housing Land Supply Order Specific Area Plan, is one of the most hotly debated proposals that's come before this council in my time as a councillor, certainly. And my deliberations have led me to accept the Planning Officer's recommendation for an approval of this stage with conditions. And I do this because the development application meets the relevant criteria of the Huntingfield Housing Land Supply Order Specific Area Plan. There are elements of this proposal that I personally like. I like the provision for public open space and aspects of the design guide, but of course it's not my role to judge the developer on their taste. It is only my role to judge the proposal on its merits, which I have done. I like the environmental protections where they exist. I like the interconnectivity of the proposal to the extent that it exists, and I like that affordable housing supply will be increased to the extent that it will under this development. I personally feel that this design could go further, but if it did, that would have obvious implications on the affordability aspect. So there's a balance that must be struck, and this proposal, in my opinion, is trying to strike that balance. There were 22 representations received against this, which are responded to in the report at length. Of particular concern to me are those relating to environmental protection, specifically the Peter Murrell Conservation Area and CAT management. I'm pleased with the recommendation for the conditions, number 24 and 26 A and B on page 76, with respect to fencing to prevent uncontrolled access to habitat within the open space zoned portion of the site and adjacent to Peter Murrell, and conditions relating to cat control and minimising bird collision by incorporating design elements and strategies in accordance with the document Minimising the Swift Parrot Collision Threat, Guidelines and Recommendations for Parrot Safe Building Design. I've also taken pains to consider bushfire management, stormwater management, the potential traffic issues, and active transport infrastructure such as bicycle lanes. We often lament the deficiencies of the planning scheme. We lament that developers can build subdivisions without separated cycleways or passive thermal design principles, for example. I lament the deficiencies in the protection of Aboriginal heritage, the lack of environmental and cultural values. Those arguments are well known by my colleagues, well rehearsed around this table, and it's not the time to relitigate those because we're here as a planning authority. I've long advocated that council as a planning authority should in fact be able to consider a much broader range of criteria than simply those imposed upon us by the state government. But as we all know, our role here is to measure this DA against the planning scheme to say whether it's permissible or not, and in this case I think it is. In 1974 this area was earmarked for housing, and soon, if this goes forward, there will be houses there, and I like to think of the 218 families that will find their place here in this special part of Lutruwita. There will be some, in fact I know that there are quite a few, who don't like this proposal. There are many who raised their concerns with me at the public consultations and raised them with me personally. It's important that we meet the community where they're at and that we match our community development with appropriate infrastructure. That's functional state roads, public transport, school and medical services. And it's important that we advocate strongly to the state government for those amenities. But again, that's not something that we as a planning authority can deal with today. I've looked at the plans and I'm drawing in my mind a balance. There are those in our community who enjoy a peaceful life in a beautiful area. They have shelter, they have security, and they are quite reasonably, they might be upset or concerned by what they see as a too dense development. I have enormous sympathy for those views. But of course, there are those constituents whom I also represent who have no such luxury of a sturdy house on a quiet street. For many, they are desperate for shelter, desperate to find an affordable place to raise a family amidst an absolute shambles of a housing market. And today, it is for them that I make my vote in accordance with the planning scheme. This is a development that I hope will bring peace and stability to those families who are the beneficiary of the proposal. Having noted that this development meets the appropriate performance criteria, I'm satisfied to proceed with the officer's recommendations and conditions. Thank you.
Thank you. I think I had next on my list Councillor Gladewright and then Councillor Street, then Councillor Bastine.
Thank you. I'd like to start with a couple of questions. The covenants relating to cats, will that be imposed on every lot in the subdivision?
Ms. Tullamore.
Through you, Mayor, yes, it will be. I'd like to know more about point 4 of recommendation number 3 on page 64. There is considerable community concern about the number of houses in this development as a whole. Would it be impossible to include this specific condition on every lot? What would the ramifications be on imposing that condition on every lot?
They're just searching for it. Ms. Tullamore.
Three, Mayor. Sorry, can we just have a repetition of what the page number was?
So 64. Point 4 of recommendation number 3 on page 64.
Through you, Mayor, the limitation was put on those lots as a transition between the existing housing area into the subject site. We wouldn't deem it fair and reasonable to stipulate that limitation on all the lots throughout the throughout that estate. It would fall to the appropriate zoning. If you were to put that restriction on all the properties, then you wouldn't you'd be defying what the zoning is. You wouldn't be following through what the zoning is, so it wouldn't be appropriate to apply that limitation to all lots within the estate.
Okay. So I'm a little bit concerned about the design guide, given that it's not a statutory document. So I note that the use of the design guide is an advisory document and not considered by our expert planners to be sustainable in achieving complying and acceptable development. How are we proposing the use of the design guideline in association with the Part 5 agreement on specific lots will provide the statutory basis to achieve the necessary compliance and quality design outcomes envisaged? Has the Department of Communities agreed to that? Like, are they aware of that condition that we're putting on them? Have they had a conversation about that?
Ms. Tullamore.
Through you, Mayor, yes, the applicant is aware of the condition we have there. So just to make it clear, the design guidelines were provided by the applicant. They engaged an architect to put that together. It has some good merit and good notions, and it also contains a lot of stuff that is not relevant to a planning assessment, down to details about preferences about whether kitchen benches, you could do homework at them and things like that. So it's not something we would normally stipulate. what we have done through the condition is that the resident would need to get approval from the Department of Communities that they're satisfied, because the Department of Communities have made this decision and sold their application to us by saying, we have these decision guidelines, this is the best outcome, we can get great outcomes on each of these lots. So rather than putting all that work on to council to have potentially an argument with someone about whether it does or doesn't meet it, it will go back to the Department of Communities, and they effectively need to sign off on it that, yes, they're achieving what the vision of Department of Communities was, that they sold to us what they want, and then it would come to council for assessment. That doesn't say that it takes away from the assessment against the planning scheme. So if you get a tick off from Department of Communities, it's not an automatic tick for the rest of it. We still have to apply with the requirements of the planning scheme, but those design guidelines have elements in there which go beyond what the planning scheme contains, which is good, and we've applied it not to all lots but to those who didn't meet the minimum requirements. So as an example, some of the lots, if they don't have the breadth across them to achieve the envelope that the planning scheme says, well, then we know that they need to come up with a more clever design to achieve that.
But we're just taking their word for it that they'll do that, right? Like, we're just trusting that they're going to go through that, or?
Through you, Mayor, it's going to be stipulated in the Part 5 agreement, so the Part 5 agreement is a legal agreement on the title, okay. So they must do that. It'll be up to Department of Communities how they do that or deal with that. Do they have a department? Do they have a person? That's up to them to work out how they do that. And I wouldn't be entirely surprised if they've not done it before, in saying that having worked in other jurisdictions, I've seen that it has worked. It does have that ability to work and give some ownership about achieving what they want to achieve.
Okay, that's interesting, because I note as well that they're agreeing to bear the cost of doing all of that as well. So.
Through you, Mayor, registration of Part 5 agreements, any applicant always has to bear the cost of that.
Right, OK. What else have I got here? The covenant relating to the 3,000 litre rainwater tanks, that's, I'm assuming that's possible on the small townhouse lot pieces of land, is it? Is that possible?
Mr Donovan.
It may be, depends on design. What we're, how we've designed the conditions is that before we'll have further conversations with them about all those matters, mm-hmm. to make sure they do work. They have to get our consent to the design guidelines first, so we'll work through those matters, and also the Part 5 as well. So we'll make sure we address those. But it's a matter of design, yes. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay. What else have we got here? I think that's answered everything, thank you. So I just want to note that the master plan has not been submitted to council for endorsement, and it would appear that as proposed may not even be capable of implementation. So that's a little concerning. And it's also concerning that the application did not provide any information about the delivery of social housing. That's also fairly concerning. So given all of that, it's a begrudgingly supportive vote from me. Thanks.
Thank you. Councillor Street.
Thank you, Mayor. Mayor, I often joke that when Councillor Cordova and I are in furious agreement about something, we've either got something really right or really wrong. But I think in this context, we're getting something really right. Like Councillor Cordova, I understand the concerns of residents, but ultimately the decision that we have to make tonight is whether this development application fits the terms of the planning scheme. And on that, I do defer to the advice of our planning staff, and I do thank them for the mountain of work that has been required to bring this before council in the statutory timeframes that are required. I suspect it probably is, if not the largest subdivision permit that council has ever considered, it would be close to being the largest, purely in terms of lot numbers that this council has ever considered. So I do thank them for their work in getting this before us. Again, like Councillor Cordova, it's heartening to me that the decision tonight is going to see many more families in Kingborough in affordable housing. That is not a planning consideration, but it is certainly heartening. And the other thing that I wanted to say this evening as well to the residents of Huntingfield, both existing and incoming over the coming years, is that while it's not a planning consideration, I want to be very clear that as a councillor, I take my obligation to hold the government of the time's feet to the fire on the commitments that they have made to the community very seriously. And while it won't be our responsibility to deliver on those commitments, it certainly will be our responsibility to make sure that we advocate for the community and ensure that those things that have been said will be done are actually done and carried forward. So again, that is not a planning consideration, but I want to be very clear tonight that I take my responsibility in that regard very, very seriously. Mayor, I agree with council staff that the development application complies with the planning scheme as it has been conditioned, and I will support the motion.
Thank you, Councillor Street. I had Councillor Bastone next and then Councillor Fox.
Thank you, Mayor. I just have a couple of questions regarding the master plan. One is on the water basin, the retarding water basin, which the bicycle and multi-use park goes right alongside. What do we have to do about safety in this concern? This is going to be at times quite deep, and we will have children riding along their bikes right on the edge of it, according to the drawing. Is there something we can do for safety on that?
Ms Tullamore.
Through you, Mayor, that's not part of this stage, that basin, and certainly when it comes down to the detailed design, which we have all the specs for, any rails or footpaths or roads and things like that, it would be looked at that stage, and it would just be in accordance with any requirements to do with open body water, which is different from swimming pools.
This is probably under the same situation then, where the development goes on to the Channel Highway, just south of the roundabout. Is that area going to be fenced off from the from the Channel Highway, or is it proposed to just be open? Because there's a pocket park there for children right on the highway.
Ms Tullamore.
Through you, Mayor, I don't believe there is a pocket park in that space. It's just open space. It's probably most likely to be landscaping because it'll provide a buffer between the highway and the houses that are there. And no, there's been no detail of fencing proposed along there.
Okay. Sorry to be pedantic about these, but having read them, I've got questions. Part of it says the public nature strips should be given over to neighbourhood gardening efforts. This is against our bylaw. So they're proposing to do something that is in contradiction to our bylaw. Is that right?
Ms Tullamore.
Through you, Mayor, perhaps that's something that they said, but it's not something that we've agreed to and isn't formed in the conditions of the permit.
Right, and again, they're asking, proposing to have composting areas at each home. That's probably not necessary, is it, since we now do FOGO? It's all these sort of things when you read through the... You wonder if they were actually looking at Kingborough or whether they lifted this off something else.
Ms Tullamore.
Through you, Mayor, I suspect that what you're reading from is the design guidelines.
Yeah.
Yes, so the design guidelines, as I commented before, have a whole raft of things that we wouldn't consider in planning that they've just suggested that are a good idea. So that will be up to them. It's not something that we're going to enforce or require necessarily.
All right. Thank you.
Councillor Fox, I believe, next. And then Councillor Midgley.
Thank you, Mayor. I'm pleased to hear most of the comments, all of the comments that I've heard so far from other councillors, and there's very little left for me to say. But I guess what concerns me most is what's written on page 17 of this report, and it's difficult to paraphrase it, but the fact is that there is no master plan that accompanies this development application, which is only for stage one, There are two other stages to come, but it appears that if the current master plan that has been modified from A to K versions, the final one, there will be conflicts with the current development applications if the other development or stages 2 and 3 go ahead in the future. There will be conflicts which will have to be resolved and negotiated, but at the moment they are unresolved and not negotiated. And what is particularly concerning to me is that there has been a significant impact assessment by North Barker, who are very concerned that this proposal will potentially threaten the Environmental Protection and Biodiversity Conservation Act through the removal of sporty spotted pardalotes and the impact on the Peter Murrell Reserve. Now, if these issues are not addressed now, and the way they're trying to address them is providing a 100-metre buffer zone, but that's going to be in conflict with the next stage. I think there is a lot more to be resolved here, and it's all dependent on the goodwill of the government and the skills of the negotiation skills of the council staff. And I have every trust in the council staff. But governments come and go, and it does concern me that we're going to end up with a situation which is possibly not going to be in the community's interest in the long term, particularly when I look at the zoning within the master plan, the current zoning, which actually includes general industry very close to the Peter Murrell Reserve. So I have great concerns, but as a planner, as a council planning officer, I mean, wearing a planner's hat in our role as a planning authority, we can only assess it on what has been put before us by our professional staff and whether it complies with the current planning scheme, which it obviously does. And I really appreciate the detail and the work that's gone into this enormous document, which in my mind is the biggest document we've ever had to analyse and discuss and absorb in the time available. And in a way, I'm pleased that the meeting was deferred because of COVID. It gave us more time to read it and to really come to grips with it. But I have great concerns about the fact that the master plan has not been approved, and I would like the government to try and get a better grip on this before the next stage comes to us, because I really think we need to do the absolute best in this beautiful location, which has got so many assets, and there'll be so many people living here. And if we don't get it right together, then we're creating something that we can't be proud of. Thank you.
Thank you, Councillor Fox. Councillor Midgley.
Thank you, Mayor, and thank you, other councillors, for your sharing. It's made me type some notes and ask a few more questions to my thoughts. And yes, I agree with Councillor Fox. It was really fantastic. We did have that extra week, and thanks that there was no extra cases as well during that time, because it was a massive report that we really had to digest, a lot of information that I had to read 3 times. And I was surprised how many community members contacted me to say they'd read it as well. So, because it is, as we all know, a significant development for Kingborough that definitely will have an impact on many, many things, more than just the roundabout congestion. I'd like to start, Mayor, with a couple of things that aren't absolutely our role as a planning authority, but I'd like to say them, but they won't be too controversial, don't worry. I'd like to start by noting that...
You can channel me in the direction, I'll just be brief.
So just to start by noting that housing is a basic human right that affords people dignity. And it's great that we finally have a DA for Huntingfield, and that was part of the fast-track land supply order in response to the housing crisis. It is a couple of years later. The process has been fraught with challenges, and it's a shame that there hasn't been transparent community conversations, that we had to push the government for engagement during the school holiday time, and that there has been a lot of to and fro requesting for a lot more information. And also with that the master plan has been changed with again noting that the government said there wasn't too many changes, but I think for that transparency it would have been good to actually release the current master plan that will be going with this DA submission that the community and councillors could be aware of. We are in new times in Tasmania regarding housing. In the past 5 years, we are now seeing and confronted by the housing crisis. As we visit Hobart, see people sleeping rough. We hear stories of friends who separated, sleeping in tents in the backyard because they can't find a home, and young people with disabilities not being able to find a home and living at home because there are no other options. Everyone has a right to a home. We all want homes for Huntingfield, and we also hope to see the infrastructure in place to support these homes, knowing that this infrastructure has a positive impact on the livelihood of people who live in these homes. These people who are going to be living in Huntingfield have a right to services close by, medical services, schools, shops, neighbourhood house and social services and public transport and active transport linkages. There are many positive things about this DA, and I thank staff for working tirelessly with the Department of Communities to ensure we have some positive outcomes. No doubt it has been a big load upon the already load of the number of submissions and applications that we're receiving and the staff shortages and things like that, so thank you so much, and that you had to chase up on so many different areas as part of this. I'd also like to acknowledge the 22 submissions by the many active community members who met with, some of them met and wrote to councils and met on site as well to show councils their local community perspective, because let's face it, they live there. They bought there with the vision for Huntingfield. They know what the traffic congestion is. They can time it how long they sit in their car to get through to the Antarctic Division or whatever. They can tell us that, and we know the infrastructure is so important. So there's many positive things about this. As I've mentioned, a home. We need homes for many, many, many Tasmanians. It's great to see the public open space, the pocket parks and the shared path throughout the development. The 3 metre pathway is fantastic. I note that there was a submission, and I'm guessing it was probably from a bike related person, in regards to the shared path being wider, because it would be great and it gives more room for cycling and pedestrians to pass each other, but it's a much better outcome than a 1.5 metre pathway. That would have been really, really disappointing. So 3 metre pathway does comply, but again it highlights some of the deficiencies of the planning scheme that we can't actually have a wider shared path in that instance. I have a few questions, and I have sent some of these already to staff, and thanks for replying, but I think for the public record and interested people, it would be good to note some of these as well. Some of the matters that councillors have raised here, again, is the master plan, and I had to grapple with how master plans generally work in regards to submissions for DAs, and especially such significant DAs and developments as this. So I'm just wondering if we could have an explanation regarding the master plan process that would typically occur for developments, and why government hasn't submitted the master plan as part of this process, and why they didn't have to, I guess, note to the community that the master plan they originally put forward has changed.
Ms. Tallamore.
Through you, Mayor, it's probably worth noting that when they did the planning scheme amendment specifically for this site, because it has a specific area plan on it, they had chosen to put in the element about the master plan. So it's not typical to get a master plan for estates, and it actually can be problematic. So one that you would be familiar with is Kingston Green, which has a master plan on it. And as you can see from that, which was debated in the chamber not long ago, they can become dated, things can change. It could be problematic moving forward about having to go back and change the master plan and things like that. So it's not something that is seen very often. It's not something that we had for Whitewater or Spring Farm. That's not to say you couldn't have it, but it does bring with it some limitations, or just another hurdle to get over, because as this estate evolves with stages 2 and 3, they will still need to come to council and make the application, and we're still going to assess it against all the criteria. So even if there was a master plan, we still need to go through that process and make sure it, you know, meets all the requirements or the performance criteria if it doesn't meet the acceptable solutions. So the master plan doesn't really offer something on top of that necessarily. What the master plan does do for the community, I guess, is gives them an idea of the concept of what it's going to be like, what the general layout is, and it's useful for council to also have an idea of what their plans are for the future. In that the very confusing part in this particular application was that a lot of the supporting documentation that came with it made reference to the whole estate. But this isn't a staged subdivision application. There was no request for it to be staged. They refer to it as stage one, which we explain in the report, that we continue to call it stage one just for clarity, but it's not like... Spring Farm, for example, has stages 1 to 5 in it, but that was all part of the initial. So we assessed the whole estate. This one we're only assessing this much of the land of a very large parcel. So from my point of view, I don't see it as the end of the world about the master plan. I think it provides good guidance. I'd be surprised if they turned around and made it radically different from what was in there, and it probably will change when they come up with the design details because the engineering doesn't quite work or the layout's a bit different. Or the other thing that could happen, like with Kingston Green, is that the market changes. Although it's probably more likely this is going to be built faster than Kingston Green, just given the current housing market, it probably will move faster.
Great. Thank you so much for that insight. Can we have an explanation on, so therefore in approving stage one, the planning authority needs to be aware, you might have already answered that, sorry, I'm just trying to grapple with what's been said and what I've written down to ask. Therefore in approving stage one, the planning authority needs to be aware that the master plan provided represents one scenario for how development of the whole site may proceed, not how it necessarily will or can proceed, until a full and complete assessment of the master plan and stages 2 and 3 is undertaken by both the planning authority and the government, Commonwealth government, the feasibility of the master plan remains unresolved. Wondering what you have in relation to that comment.
Ms. Tullamore.
Through you, Mayor, yes, it may change from that. As I mentioned, it'll still be dealt with on its own merits and need to have good reason why it's changed, but we can't hold them to the master plan. And it would be appropriate that they make it as relevant to the time of which they want to develop it. So that's what I'm saying about the trends might change, or the need or the demand. The market of how these properties sell is probably also likely to dictate what they're going to do for the other lots. But if it has a huge departure from what the zoning requirements are, that's a planning scheme amendment, because this does have a specific area plan about zones and requirements on those allotments.
Great, thank you. I understand this next question is not a planning authority, but as it was a fast-track land supply order, it's in regards to the affordable housing component. So how, and I understand it's in regards to the design guide that they've supplemented as a document to support this in regards to how they're going to fulfil the affordable housing component of this. So when they talk about the affordable housing component, is it just the smaller lots? As stated, the intent of the smaller lots is to enable their release at lower prices than the vacant lots currently in the housing market, making the land component more affordable. And the affordable housing strategy states, affordable housing refers to rental homes or home purchases that are affordable to low-income households, meaning that the housing costs are low enough that the household is not in the housing stress or crisis. In response to that, is there any, how can we be assured that we don't have developers buying these low-cost housing and sitting on them or sitting on the land banking and things like that? Like, how can we be assured that the housing affordable part of this reason why we've fast-tracked it, how can we be assured that it will go to affordable people? We
you
can't.
Have just crossed that line out of the remit of the planning authority, no matter how much you tried to stay in it. But in short, I know that we did actually, that question was asked when we had the minister here and some of his advisers, and the question that they answered that question in saying that that was something that they would be overseeing when they sell off the lots of land to the developers. They gave that assurance in this room only a few weeks ago, if you recall. I don't know if Ms. Tullamore wants to add anything to that question that isn't really a part of the Planning Authority deliberations.
It's correct. We don't have any ability to enforce what was suggested they were going to do. It would be my interpretation of the design that affordable comes down to that they're smaller lots, so they cost less. There's no limitation or requirement that it has to be social housing or affordable housing, which are two different things and actually have numerous definitions in the relevant legislation, which we didn't delve into too much in this. And we can't really stipulate, there's a requirement to do that, which you could do in other states potentially, but it doesn't exist in our scheme to be able to hold them to account of making it affordable or how much of it is affordable.
Thank you. I hope we have people on council to hold them to account to that, because it is important we have the affordable housing. So the issues raised by the PMCA, what is the future of that, and what are we going to do in regards to the future stages? If we could have a bit of a summary in regards to that, because that is quite a big concern.
Is that not really relevant to... You've jumped over the line now,
all right.
I'm afraid.
Okay, that's all right. So in regards to traffic, we have a traffic impact assessment report. Mm-hmm. Many people in the community have asked, so when was the traffic impact completed, at what times of the day, and does it take into account the future high school development in the area?
Ms. Tyler-Moore or Mr. Donovan?
Through you, Mayor, we would have to have time to look at that. I don't have it straight off-handed. I don't recall exactly in the representations.
That's okay. That's all right. I mean, again, it's one of those... I thought I didn't ask that earlier, but it is a very important matter, as you know, for the many houses that are going to this area. And in regards to the Aboriginal heritage, so I just had to grapple with that one as well in regards to what the condition was. So what if the permit is not given... So Aboriginal heritage, what if the permit isn't given, and why isn't the permit given prior to the decision going to council?
Ms. Tyler-Moore.
I understand that a bit more.
Through you, Mayor, as mentioned before, we don't have jurisdiction over the Aboriginal requirements. It's not written into the Act that says you cannot issue a permit until the Aboriginal matters are resolved, which has been introduced into Victoria as an example. So there's no way that we can hold up our decision-making. The condition that you refer to is not a condition but an advice clause, so we're unable to enforce it. We're giving them the heads up, watch out, you better look out, make sure you get your ducks lined up. The question about what happens if they don't get a permit, then they can't act on the permit. So it's not dissimilar to, we may give a planning permit for you to build a house, but if you can never achieve a building permit, you just can't build it. You just can't use your planning permit if you can't get your other approvals lined up. So perhaps a scenario would be that particular, less likely for relics, but a particular site of significance, they said, no way, you really need to stay out of that. Then the developer would either not develop at all, which is unlikely, or they would come back to council and ask for an amendment to their application to preclude that area, as an example, from their application. So it would need to come back to the planning department for consideration as an amendment.
Okay, thank you. Thanks for that understanding of that process. So I will support this very important development for the many needed homes in our Kingborough and Tasmanian community. And I thanks again to staff for all of the work going into this. Thanks to all the people who have submitted and taken action and lobbied and talked to councillors about this, because it is really important. It's great that people are getting involved. I really hope that it has a positive outcome, and that it is right for the community and the people who live here in the future. I hope that we have made the right choices, and I hope the government has made the right, putting the right things in place to ensure that it is going to be a great place for people to live. So we know it's not the best design, but really that's a matter of the larger scale of things under the role of the planning scheme. And as Councillor Fox said, there is a lot more to be resolved for the future stages, and we are placing a lot of trust in government in this. I also trust our fantastic staff in regards to their negotiations, and I thank them again for the significant time.
Thank you, Councillor Midgley. Councillor Westwood.
Thank you, Mayor. I also accept the advice from staff that this meets the planning scheme. I would just like to understand a little bit more about the design guidelines and the Part 5 agreement. This is something unusual that I haven't seen before. A note on page 64 at points 2 and 3, we note that where a development application is required to be lodged with the planning authority, it must be accompanied by the Department of Communities approval. If an application doesn't meet the design guidelines and doesn't get approval from the Department of Communities, what are the next steps from there for the planning authority? Are the design principles enforceable? Which ones aren't enforceable, and what steps might council have to require developers to comply with that Part 5 agreement that enforces the design principles?
Ms Tyler Moore.
Through you, Mayor, it'll be up to the Department of Communities how they set up their approval system for the members of the public or the purchasers. It might be built into their contract of sale. It's one way that they could do it. They would need to, I would think, this is up to them, not us, have a way that you would have an appeal right to them or something. But basically, when it comes to us, we're not concerned with that. We're not concerned about the process that they go through. So long as it has that letter of approval from the Department of Communities, that's what we need to understand. And the elements within the design guidelines, as mentioned, not all of them are planning related. Some of them are quite aspirational. There's some parts in there which are very nice in notion. Whether it's achieved or whether it's too specific about what everyone has to have is another debate, and that's why we don't believe that we should take responsibility of having to say whether or not it's met that. That's up to the Department of Communities. They have based this on... they've told us several times about a subdivision in South Australia that had something similar, I believe. I've never seen the planning permit or whether they had the design guidelines or whether it was the same, and how they went about ensuring that there was compliance with what they had put forward as an appropriate outcome for a subdivision that didn't meet all the acceptable solutions.
So as long as council receives approval from the Department of Communities that the proposed development meets the design guidelines, that meets the condition that we're imposing. Is that right?
Ms Tyler Moore.
Through you, Mayor, just that particular requirement that they need approval from Department of Communities, but it doesn't give them approval for the planning permit. So they might get the tick off from Department of Communities that meets that document, but we might read it and say, no, well, it's overlooking or it's overshadowing one of the requirements that we have to assess, so it's not an automatic given that if you just meet it with them that you're going to meet it with us.
Okay. Because I guess, just as a general comment, I agree with some of the comments that this is based on goodwill. I think we got off to a fairly rocky start with the former Minister for Housing, with the rezoning of the land taken out of council's hands. I think there has been some recent efforts to build back some of that good faith with our community through recent infrastructure commitments. And so I'm comfortable that the state government and council can work together. I'm just wanting to make sure that while we are holding the state government to a higher account than we would a normal developer, I would just like to, express my expectation that when the lots are developed they will be in accordance with the design guidelines as has been presented, because they do look contemporary and they do take into account a lot of detailed things, but I accept the fact that where we are at the moment that the proposal in front of us meets the planning scheme.
Thank you. I just had a question before I make my contribution. I just had a question in relation to cat control. I understand that we're going to ask for a covenant rather than a Part 5 agreement to prohibit people in Stage 1 from keeping cats because of the threat to wildlife in the Peter Murrell Reserve. And then the page I'm looking at on page 60 at 2.6.1 goes on to say that there's a social housing component and there may be people who are in need of social housing but also have an existing cat, and keeping the cat is important to their mental and emotional well-being. It is therefore proposed that the prohibition is qualified, includes an option for council to exercise discretion to approve the keeping of a cat provided the cat is contained within the property boundary. Now, given they're going to be as a covenant and it's likely that some of these people will be renters, how does that work? Does that just mean that as part of their lease that they would then have a provision in their lease about not being able to keep a cat or the cat being contained if they get exemption to have a cat?
It's not our role to stipulate what needs to go on a lease. We're certainly not involved in leases, but it would make good sense that they put that in because it applies to owners and occupiers, so renters. So it would be appropriate and responsible of the tenancy to include that in there and stipulate that.
Okay, thank you. Thank you for that. Look, this is certainly, as many councillors have articulated, this has been certainly an unprecedented subdivision and development application that we have before us, and it's certainly been an unprecedented process, I think, in terms of the way that it unfortunately started. I think that there was division within the community at the start because of the lack of widespread consultation within the Huntingfield community, and I really wish, and I guess I would imagine the state government perhaps in hindsight realises that perhaps they could have introduced this concept to that existing Huntingfield community in a better way at that time to be more inclusive of the consultation. I wanted to also thank the 22 members of the community who put considerable thought into their submissions and their representations against this. There was a wide range of issues that were covered in those, and they are all dealt with in the report, but some of the things that they talked about were the master plan, design issues, traffic issues, the impact on Peter Murrell Reserve, bicycle infrastructure, the business zone, environment, stormwater, animals, bushfire management, lack of community infrastructure and adjacent property impacts. And so I think that demonstrates the broad nature of concern across the community and wanting to have some assurances as to what the end result of this would certainly look like. I'm pleased that we're able to offer an additional week for people to respond to make representations, and I know I certainly took the time along with some of my fellow councillors to walk around the site and get a feel for it and understand it. It's very difficult to do it by just looking at the plans, and even though the weather wasn't very favourable that day, it certainly was a valuable exercise. I am, like others have expressed earlier, I'm disappointed that we came to this through the fast-tracking of the rezoning, and I understand that the state government did have its reasons for doing so, but, you know, that really is at the heart of the start of this process not being as consultative as it possibly could have been, and making this a very difficult task for all concerned. As others have mentioned, I think there are, because I think everybody has collectively highlighted some of the touch points and things that do concern us and concern residents, things like I do believe that the traffic is going to be continue to be an issue. I do think that the lack of other infrastructure that we can't talk about as a planning authority, but we'll talk about it future opportunities. I do hope that the state government takes those things seriously, because I do believe that we will find ourselves, when this is developed, needing those facilities. But I think there are some things also to be pleased about with this. I think the street tree plan, I was expecting Councillor Cordova to actually talk about that at length, and I think you mentioned it in passing, but one tree per lot is to be planted, and that's something that we haven't seen on to that scale in a development application. I like the walkability of it and the connectiveness, which is very important in our communities, the shared pathways, the things like the future provision for bus stop areas for seating around the walkability, the traffic calming measures around the public open space. I do have concerns about the location of the public open the large public open space, and I can see Councillor Glade-Wright is is nodding in agreement because on that very wet and windy day that we walked it, it is in the far bottom corner, and I think there's going to have to be a lot of work done to make that a workable and usable playground area, and it's very much stuck back in the corner at the bottom, and it was, when we were there, it was not a pleasant place to be, so I imagine there's a lot of work to be done around there. But things like the requirements that are in there to have like water bubblers and dog drink bowls in the public open space area, to have seating near those playgrounds, I think those things are all really important, that we do recognise that there has been some effort made to try and get the best result. And it's not often I go to time, so I will finish. And just, can I just have 1 minute? I just wanted to thank staff. Thank you. So move Councillor Midgley, seconded Councillor Gladewright, that I be given an extra 1 minute to speak, please. All those in favour?
Aye.
Against? Thank you. Motion is nearly carried. I just wanted to finalise by just saying there has been an unprecedented amount of work that has gone into this by our staff, and particularly Mr Donovan and Ms Tyler Moore, so I thank them for the tremendous amount of work that they have done. But I also did want to acknowledge, as I said earlier, the community members, and we have two of them with us tonight, but I did want to single out Matt Jones for the work that he has done on behalf of the Huntingfield residents in being a very, very strong voice about this. And you've done a tremendous job in researching this and living, eating and breathing it for the last 18 months, and for helping to inform all of us. So I thank you on behalf of all of us as well for the work that you've done. And as I said, it's a difficult one, and one that we probably wish we had a little bit more latitude with, but as others have mentioned, we have to assess this as a planning authority, and relying on the advice of our expert and qualified planners, we have to accept that this meets the planning scheme, and therefore I will also be supporting this. Thank you. Councillor Wass, did you want to sum up? Yes. Oh, Councillor Midgley has a question.
I've thought of a few questions more.
Okay.
It's in regards to the Aboriginal Heritage part, and is the Aboriginal Heritage Report available to the public, the Aboriginal Heritage Report for Huntingfield?
Tullamore.
Through you, Mayor, we don't have a copy of the report to be able to provide.
Okay, but is it a document that is available to the public? I guess it's a general question.
Through you, Mayor, I wouldn't be able to say with confidence with that. You would need to speak to either the applicant, the author of the report, or Aboriginal Tasmania as whether that's available.
Thank you. If I can just have another explanation regarding the process for the permit. So basically it's a minister that signs off for the permit. Is that correct? So I think it falls under maybe Elise Archer's portfolio.
Ms Tullamore.
Through you, Mayor, I'm afraid I don't know the exact process of it because we don't deal with it directly. It would be appropriate for the questions to be directed to Aboriginal Tasmania. And I would also like to say that I would like to apologise because I've no doubt called them Aboriginal Tasmania all evening, and that's probably not their technical name now. So my apologies, and there's no offence caused, but I didn't have on hand what the latest title of their department is.
Thank you.
Thank you. And for one of the oldest cultures on earth, how can we be assured that the stone quarry and the associated artefacts scatters site that's named in the report be protected?
Dr. Stevenson.
There we go. Through you, Mayor. As Ms Tyler Moore has explained, Aboriginal Heritage Tasmania, under the Aboriginal Heritage Act, is the permitting authority. So they are also the compliance authority in relation to Aboriginal heritage. So prior to, as the advice says, in the where all the conditions are, the applicant must receive that permit, and then Aboriginal Heritage Tasmania will be the one to ensure there's compliance with their permit conditions. So they own the permit in the same way that we own the planning permit.
Thank you. Councillor Wass, did you want to sum up?
Yes, thank you, Mayor. I think this has been the longest talked and discussed DA that we've probably ever had. It's good that the community have been on board, because I think some of the changes that have been brought about by their feelings and reactions, and certainly from council's perspective, it has been discussed generally up until the time we got the DA, when we actually saw what was in it. Huntingfield, as we all know, was identified for residential purposes, I think, about the 1970s or even before that. In the 1980s, we were told that Huntingfield was going to be the benchmark for housing in Australia, and looking at the design guide accompanying the development application, I believe that supports those comments and certainly indicates a desirable suburb to either live in or to visit, which is pleasing. It has a mix of housing options, including affordable housing, and as our planners have said, it meets the recommendations of Council's planning scheme, and on that basis I recommend to all and sundry that Council should look at it and should recommend approval.
Thank you. I'll now put the motion. It was moved by Councillor Wass, seconded by Councillor Midgley. It is as printed on page 63. It has 30 conditions. All those in favour? Against? The motion is carried unanimously. The Planning Authority now adjourns, and the open session of Council recommences at 6:46 p.m. Moving to page 187, motions of which notice has been given. There is a notice of motion for Councillor Westwood, headed Council Meetings, and an officer's response from Mr Arnold. I have a mover in Councillor Westwood, a seconder in Councillor Midgley. Councillor Westwood.
Thank you, Mayor. This notice of motion follows up from a similar notice of motion that I submitted about 12 months ago. This notice of motion hopefully is sufficient to enable council meetings to change from the second and fourth Monday of each month to the first and third Monday on an ongoing basis. Traditionally, council meetings have been held on the second and fourth Mondays of the month. What this has meant is that almost every month in the first half of the year, one of our council meetings moves from a Monday to a Tuesday, and we pick up our agenda papers on a Thursday instead of a Wednesday. It might sound trivial, however, often our agenda papers are 300 pages plus long, and when you have 4 days to read, consult, ask questions and inform yourself before sitting in a meeting and reaching a position on behalf of the community, there's a lot of work that goes into digesting that information over 4 days, and when it's part of a long weekend, it makes it very difficult to have a break. I think for councillors and staff, using long weekends to actually have a break, as opposed to having to read 300 pages of agenda papers and ask questions of staff, it would certainly be better if we could avoid that if possible. This year we have held meetings on the first and third Monday, and from my perspective it has worked quite well in avoiding long weekends. It's meant that we can have a bit of a break when we do have a public holiday, and I think in terms of a work-life balance and something that can help in this busy day and age to contribute to mental health and wellbeing, I would really support and ask my colleagues to support that we continue the practice of meeting on the first and third Monday of each month, as opposed to the second and fourth Monday of each month.
Thank you. Councillor Gladewright?
Just had a question. Do we need to put in a time frame, like an end date to this proposal, or is it just proposed that it's forever? Or how does it,
work? I think the error in last year's motion was that it was only for 2021.
Right.
So this is not having an end date, so it's basically changing it for good now, so we don't have to come back and do this every year.
Okay.
Yep. Councillor Fox?
Yes, I support the motion. I'm interested what a difference it has made to change the date. It's just a subtle shift, but it has made it easier for us. But I'm interested also that it states in the local government meeting procedures regulations that stipulates that an ordinary meeting of council is to be held at least once in each month. And I'm surprised that it needs a motion like this to change the how often we meet and when we meet. I would have, and which weeks. I'm surprised that this notion is actually necessary. I appreciate it because we're all agreed, I hope, and it's to our benefit, but I just guess from a procedural point of view, is this motion actually necessary, and would it require a motion of rescission for future councils if they want to change it in any way, or are we now locked in?
I'm just trying. I believe we've got a policy somewhere that indicates when we meet, Dr. Stevenson.
We have to publish in advance our council meeting dates for the year. So it is important that we're all on the same page, and having a council decision makes that easier. But you're right. To change it is bringing a motion back. But there's no. I don't think there's any real barrier if down the track there needed to be a change.
Any further speakers on the motion? If not, I will put it, which is that council agree to hold ordinary meetings of council on the first and third Monday of each month, with the exception of the first Monday in January, commencing in 2022. It's moved by Councillor Westwood and seconded by Councillor Midgley. All those in favour?
Aye.
Against? The motion is carried unanimously. Staying on that same page, we have a notice of motion from Councillor Westwood in relation to food truck policy, and a seconder in Councillor Gladewright. Councillor Westwood.
Thank you. This notice of motion comes about because on the 6th of September, when we considered for the second time our food truck policy, we made a change that I have to admit, in reading my however many pages of agenda papers, I missed a bit of crossed out text that changed our policy from having food trucks, a single individual food truck allowed to trade at Kingston Beach three times, a maximum of three times in any week, to once per week. There is a petition that has been started by the community. It has nearly 600 signatures, and that petition calls for council to review the change we made in the policy recently. It also calls for more consultation around food truck trading. After having revisited this issue for the third time, I can see that there is a little bit of work that we need to do, particularly at Kingston Beach, around food truck trading in relation to car parking issues. There are a number of things. For example, the policy stipulates that a food truck must park in a designated car parking area. So this creates issues for pretty much all stakeholders involved. It creates issues for the food trucks who struggle to get there in busy peak seasons. If a food truck does manage to get there, it takes away parking spots for other people who would be visiting the area to use the beach and potentially patronage the existing established businesses that are there. And it also impacts the established businesses because obviously there are less parking spots available for people to frequent their venue. The policy we approved, I think, is an improvement, particularly in relation to Kingston Beach, because it designates a specific area that's just down past Victoria Street, on where Victoria Street meets Osborne Esplanade. So it has a single designated area where food trucks must trade from, so they can't pull up anywhere along that strip, for example, directly opposite the existing businesses that are there. So I support their policy as approved, but I have to admit that I was not aware of the fairly substantial change we made in relation to the number of trading days at that site. I know it is winter at the moment, but I don't think we currently have the amount of competition between food trucks to warrant limiting one individual operator to only patronage that area once per week. We have stipulated the times, we've stipulated the location, and I think the market, aside from having some kind of booking system, the market is currently able to work out between itself which food trucks will be there for a four-hour period on each day. So what I'm hoping to do tonight is to change the policy back to what it was as of a couple of weeks ago, so that on Osborne Esplanade at Kingston Beach, a individual food truck can trade a maximum of 3 days per calendar week, not just one day, which is what the new policy stipulated. And the reason I'm doing this now, as opposed to waiting for the current petition to close, it doesn't close until early next month, is because I do think that that this has an impact on people being able to earn a living, food truck operators being able to earn a living, and it seems nonsensical to limit them to one day per week when the rest of the week potentially there are other food trucks who won't be in that same area. So just to emphasise that it is one specific part of the policy that was approved on the 6th of September that I am trying to change back to what it was at that point in time.
Thank you, Councillor Westwood. Councillor Fox.
Thank you, Mayor. I'd like to ask the staff at this point why there isn't a formal response to this situation included in this motion. I have concerns that we're changing policy on the run without staff guidance, and I'd like to know if there were reasons that we've not been aware of, why the change was made, the recommended change was made by staff from 3 days to one. And I'm just hoping that the staff can answer, give me a broad understanding of the situation as they see it from their professional perspective.
Thank you. Mr. Reeve.
Through you, Mayor. Yes, as was stated in the original report that was back in September there, one of the reasons we put forward that change there was after getting some comments back, particularly from the local businesses there, but also residents as well at the same time there, that were concerned about the amenity with the trading as it was. So therefore, as a compromise situation, we made that amendment to the policy. The reason why the response to the motion is relatively short from an officer's perspective there is because in reality it wouldn't probably make too much difference from an officer's perspective whether it was with 3 days a week or the 1 day a week there. Either one can be accommodated, and it really does sit within the council's domain to make that decision as compared to the officers.
Thank you. Councillor Gladright.
Thank you. Sorry, I don't quite understand the explanation, because by changing it back to the 3 days, you can still, or if it's 1 day, you can have seven lots of trucks there, or if it's 3 days, you can have three, and another one in 1 week. So it doesn't actually change anything, does it, in terms of a food truck being there or not? So how is it a compromise?
Dr. Stevenson.
I'll get Mr. Reeve to correct me if I'm wrong, but my understanding was it was to ensure that we didn't have a particular trader saturating the one spot available, so that it was shared around all the available food truck traders. Now, if you had no booking on a particular day and there was no competition, I don't think the policy would apply. But in summer, when we might have 15 food trucks on it who all want to be down there, it was ensuring that there was, that we were able to spread the love, so to speak.
Okay.
So it doesn't impact the number of trucks there at any one time. It just meant that every trader had, you know, more traders had the opportunity to trade in a lucrative spot.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so I don't feel like we have lots and lots and lots of food trucks that are in competition in that spot, and given that it's only a 4-hour time slot, you can still have two trucks there, and then, sorry, I'm not great at maths in my head, but if it's two trucks in a period of 3 days and another two trucks in a period of 3 days and then the seventh day, that's still at least six different vendors that are getting the opportunity to be at, in Osborne Esplanade in any given week. Is that correct?
In my head,
yeah.
Yes, and yeah. I'm not very good at maths either.
Yeah. So in that sense, given we've got this overwhelming response from the community saying we want our food vans back longer than one day, I really thank Councillor Westwood for bringing this to council, and I didn't realise that you could do that and bring something to council before a petition ended, but apparently you can, so thank you. I think it's great that we're responding to the community in this way, and if in the future we were to get an overwhelming petition from food trucks saying the policy is unfair, then I think at that point that's when you would consider the change to this type of thing, as it was. Yeah.
Thank you. I think I had Councillor Cordova and then Bastone.
Thank you, Mayor. My contribution is that I went back and watched the council meeting YouTube live stream from the 6th of September when we discussed this, and there was a real heavy emphasis at that time on, I think, really interesting points about the competition, the business competition versus choice. That was essentially what the arguments were about. And a lot of councillors raised this idea of really in summertime that's when you want the choice, and in wintertime that's where you want to try and protect the local businesses who really they pay more in terms of rates and they employ more people, they support the community probably more than a food truck does. So to that extent, I also think that there's some small risk, not a large one, but a small risk in if we change our mind every couple of weeks on, you know, this is the third time food trucks have come back. Having said that, we're an agile council and I think we can be agile and the community responds to that. My compromise position that I would like to offer is an amendment to this where we would simply add to the very end of the sentence there, for no more than 3 days per calendar week during daylight savings and 1 day per week during all the other months. So that's my amendment, which would make this a summertime change, and that would I feel like that would find a balance between helping the local businesses who are already bricks and mortar and are making that a vibrant area. During the winter, they really shouldn't have to have that extent of competition.
Can I just ask you to repeat that amendment, and then we'll ask the mover and seconder if they agree with it?
That council agree to amend its food truck policy and associated food truck trading document to enable food trucks to trade at Osborne Esplanade for no more than 3 days per calendar week during daylight savings and 1 day per week all other months.
I think that is almost the opposite of what I would have thought. But anyway...
Is it the opposite? What do you mean by that?
Well, because the greater demand is during summer. So when you've got the greater demand, you would want to have it available to more food truck operators to be there.
Yes, that's correct.
That's what I want. But that's not what you've said. You've got to flip it around. It's the other way.
Please flip it around.
So it would be 3 days per week, the opposite, during...
One day per week during daylight savings, 3 days.
Because I do remember foreshadowing that when we had the... when we had the last debate and suggesting I'd be happy to move something like that if there's any appetite, and everyone went no. Anyway, is that acceptable to, now that we've got the wording of that right, Councillor Westwood and Councillor Glade right?
No.
Okay.
Sorry.
So we'll have to treat it as a separate amendment then. So do you want to move that as a separate amendment? It's not acceptable to...
Can I listen to the rest of the debate and then propose it again if I feel the need to propose it? Because I... Yep. Well, let's just debate. Can we debate the amendment?
Yeah,
Correct. I will move.
If you put it. Yeah. Okay.
Is it a good idea? I don't know. I'm trying to read the room here.
Yeah. It is a good idea.
Okay. So I've got an amendment that's moved by Councillor Cordova and seconded by Councillor Street. Wow. There's the odd couple again tonight. Councillor Cordova, please put your case on the amendment.
Oh, yeah, I've already made my case. And I think during the meeting of the 6th of September, I think this was really the area of discussion that we centred on the most. I feel like this is essentially a compromise position. We need to prove that we're an agile council who is able to deal with these things when they come before us, but also, you know, I think it's a compromise position.
Thank you. There would have to be some changing of that wording because it doesn't follow the way it is. We can't just add that sentence. So the motion would actually be to add the following sentence after the words Oswald Nass, after, so delete, it would read, delete the words for no more than 3 days per calendar week after Osborne Esplanade and insert the following sentence. Because otherwise it says, it will say, it will be incorrect. Okay, so on the amendment, I've got Councillor Street, then Bastone.
Thank you, Mayor. Look, I will foreshadow that if this amendment is lost, I wouldn't vote for Councillor Westwood's original motion. I would vote for the amended motion. I'm not going to re-canvass all of my views on this from the debate around the food truck policy. I'm prepared to accept that potentially we went too far in terms of one day per week for the entire year when we updated the policy, and that there should be some room to move on that. I suspect that this is not going to satisfy all of our petitioners, but the reality is that there is no circumstance here in which we are going to satisfy all of the stakeholders in this matter. I think we get closer to a logical and fair balance with Councillor Cordova's amended motion, and I'd be prepared to vote for it on that basis.
Thank you, Councillor Street. Councillor Bastone and then Councillor Gladwright.
I'd like to defer this motion altogether. We are a week off the petition ending, and I think to bring something to council when we've got a petition due in a week is ridiculous. I think we should be waiting until the petition comes in. There's no point otherwise. What's the point of people doing a petition?
Thank you, Councillor Bastone, Councillor Gladewright, then Councillor Midgley, then Councillor Westwood.
I was just going to say, I think it's ridiculous that we're all here trying to actually work out what to do when I think this needs to go to public consultation and find out what the community really want. So where that comes into play, I'm not sure. But I'm aware that if we let the petition conclude, and then what's the process? It takes quite a while, doesn't it? It has to come to council, we have to acknowledge it or something, and then wait for an officer's report, which is another fortnight, and then there's a whole lot of other things. So I think it was great that we're responding to the community in this way and putting it back to how it was, but I do acknowledge that the petition is also asking for that consultation process.
Thank you, Councillor Midgley.
Thank you. I think this probably goes on record, Councillor Fox, correct me if I'm wrong, for maybe the longest policy debate about something that we've sat and talked about.
Oh, no, dogs, I think, still win.
Oh, dogs, okay. I'm not a food truck owner. I'm not a business owner in Kingston Beach, but I do know that in developing the original policy that staff did consult and engage with food truck owners and Kingston Beach business owners. Can we have an understanding as to why that original policy was changed, what conversation provoked that change, and perhaps if there's any other insight to the engagement that we have had with the food truck owners? I'm not disregarding staff's work in that space at all, but but it is disappointing now that the food truck, that people have had to put a petition forward, that we haven't done something right there in the engagement around that. So if I can just have some understanding in regards to that kind of bigger picture.
Mr. Reeve.
Through you, Mayor. Yes, certainly we've received comments back from the businesses, as I mentioned, in terms of the general amenity from the area there, but also from the food truck operators as well. Kingston Beach is by far the most popular of all the locations there, so having equitable sort of use of that area there was something that's actually been raised by them. I guess from a business perspective there, it's more about actually having food truck vans in that area at all, but also it's actually a little bit about, I guess, the amount of time any particular food truck van of any description might actually be in that area as well. So I suppose this was one way of actually trying to get a bit of a compromise situation there where you got a greater turnover, greater ability for other people to actually use the space as well, that we actually put forward as for council consideration. So we're certainly aware of the petition there. We're aware that there will be need to be a response to that one as well at the same time. I guess that will be the opportunity to also talk about this matter there. But that's the main reasons why we've actually made that, I guess, that change to the original policy.
Thank you. So in that engagement, did we talk to all of the business owners in Kingston Beach?
Through you, Mayor. We certainly haven't gone out and done a formal engagement with all the business owners there, so most of the stuff we've actually collected is from information that we've actually received from individual businesses there, so we certainly haven't put out a formal survey of any description there. I know that I've met with some of the businesses myself down through there, and they've voiced some concerns over the last few months or so, and I know other council officers have also had some dealings with the various businesses in that location as well at the same time there.
In regards to the food truck providers, what was the engagement process for that? Please.
Mr. Reeve.
Through you, Mayor. As I said, there was not a formal engagement process with the food truck operators there, so most of the information we have got is from, I guess, feedback that we've actually had over the last couple of years or so, and certainly we've had quite a bit of feedback from the various food truck operators there as to where they want to trade, why they want to trade, what they actually want to bring to the area and so forth there. So, as I said, not a formal one, more an informal.
Thank you. That's interesting that it wasn't formal, because I guess it doesn't really have that accountability in a report to actually really see what everybody had to say, and therefore we've come to a petition because people weren't happy with the council decision. And again, I think the amendment put forward by Councillor Cordova, that is, I like it, but I also don't see that coming from any sort of solid community engagement process. So I think kind of we're making it up and assuming maybe what they might like. That's how I see perhaps that amendment, and also perhaps both of them really, all of them really, because there hasn't been a really thorough formal process of engagement. So I won't support the amendment. I'll support the original motion. I would like us to see that we review the policy a long time prior to the daylight savings for next year occur, and that we have a really thorough engagement process that provides a report and some, because it is a growing area, the food trucks in Kingborough, and I think it needs a more formal engagement structure around that that provides accountability and responses. So that's my opinion.
Okay. All right, Councillor Westwood.
On the amendment, thank you. I acknowledge that the amendment proposed is trying to provide a compromise situation. However, we have agreed that we are happy for one food truck to be in one location on Osborne Esplanade between 9 a.m. and 6 p.m. I don't know that it is really up to us to dictate which food truck it is. And at the moment, I haven't had any incidences reported to me of food truck operators standing in the middle of Kingston Beach screaming at each other saying, well, you were here yesterday, it's my turn now. I'm aware Devonport has a booking system for food trucks. Maybe that's something that we could consider as this grows potentially, and as the popularity of Kingston Beach grows, as our population is growing. But for me, if we've agreed as a council that we're happy for one food truck in one site to be on Osborne Esplanade, I think it's going too far for us to try and regulate how many times a food truck can or can't be there. So whether a food truck is there 3 days, a maximum of 3 days per week, or a maximum of 1 day per week, I think that is going beyond what the market requires us to do in terms of intervention at this moment. And that's why I don't support the amendment.
Thank you. Councillor Cordova.
Almost like a procedural question, really. And I'll preface it by saying what I want to achieve is more engagement and more consultation to actually get this right. I don't think I want to be doing this again for the fourth time. Procedurally, can I withdraw the motion in the amendment? No, I can't. Okay, that's what I'm hearing. I would like to wait. I would like to defer this, essentially, as Councillor Bastone suggested. I want to wait until we get the results of the petition in and also the consultation. I want to make sure that I believe firmly in a compromised position, but I want it to be predicated upon the opinions of the food truck operators, the customers and the businesses, not just off my compromised position off the top of my head. So, you know, my intentions were good, I think, but I would prefer that we get this right rather than just going with my idea off the top of my head.
Thank you. Okay. What we'll need to do is then put the amendment, which you can vote against if you want to. So I'll put the amendment now that is moved by Councillor Cordova and seconded by Councillor Street, the amendment to the motion. So the motion now reads that Council agree to amend its food truck policy 4.12 and associated food truck trading locations document to enable food trucks to trade at Osborne Esplanade for no more than 1 day per week during daylight savings and 3 days per week all other months. All those in favour? Against? No. The motion is lost. Returning to the substantive motion, Councillor Wass.
Thank you, Mayor. I don't think there's too many of us that can do it. So I would like to, I think, because there is pending petition coming, and because we want to get it right first time and not bring this up time and time again, I'd like the matter to be deferred until after the petition is received.
So I have a deferral motion from Councillor Wass. It's seconded by Councillor Bastone. The question is that the matter be deferred. All those in favour?
Aye.
Against?
Aye.
I'll have a division. All those in favour of the motion being deferred is Councillors Cordova, Wass, Fox, Bastone and myself. Those against is Councillors Midgley, Bladewright, Street and Westwood. The matter will be deferred. Okay, moving on. Let's make it the last time we discuss it the next time. All right. Look, I think we might have a short break, just a quick comfort break of like 5 or 6 minutes before we get into our officers' reports to council. So we'll reconvene in, try and make it 7:25 if we can. The recording is on, please.
Yes.
Thank you. So we are, welcome back. We just needed a quick comfort break. We are on page 188, petitions still being actioned. At the time printing the agenda, there were no petitions being actioned. Petitions received in the last period at the time the agenda was compiled, no petitions had been received. Moving to officers' reports to council on page 189, we have a request from Glamorgan Spring Bay Council and Clarence City Council to amend the Southern Tasmanian Regional Land Use Strategy with a recommendation on page 192. Do I have a mover or a seconder, please? Councillor Fox, and seconded by Councillor Midgley. Councillor Fox.
Thank you, Mayor. I'll just read the conclusion from the report. Glamorgan Spring Bay Council and Clarence Council have requested amendments to the Southern Tasmanian Regional Land Use Strategy. Requests for amendments to a regional strategy use strategy must be supported by all councils within the region, while the information provided by both Glamorgan, Spring Bay and Clarence Council indicate that the amendments to the strategy may be reasonable to address current residential land supply issues at the local level, the potential impacts on the growth management strategies of the Southern Tasmanian Regional Land Use Strategy and available land supply across the region has not been modelled. The impacts for Kingborough and the rest of the region are therefore unknown, and that is why the council staff are recommending that we do not support the request from Glamorgan Spring Bay Council or Clarence City Council to amend the Southern Tasmanian Regional Land Use Strategy, and I can see no argument with that reasoning, and therefore I recommend the motion. Thank you.
Thank you, Councillor Fox. Councillor Street.
Thank you, Mayor. A question to start off with, and I'm sorry, I know that we have done these before, but I think it's important in the context that the advice is refusal, that I just get an idea of, can somebody briefly restate the process for requesting an amendment to the Strelas and what steps that goes through, please?
Dr. Stevenson.
Through you, Mayor. So it's not a statutory process. It's based on guidance provided by the Planning Policy Unit. And that is because the Southern Tasmanian Regional Land Use Strategy is out of date and there's a commitment to review it. And so this advice was provided to support these sorts of conversations in the meantime. And so at the moment it does require that the process is that all councils are asked whether they support it. There is an expectation that modelling will be provided that helps councils consider the regional picture and the impact on their municipality in the way that would normally be provided through the Southern Tasmanian Regional Land Use Strategy process. Even if we don't support it as a council, it doesn't necessarily mean it's dead. It still goes to the minister for the minister's consideration, and we're just a part of the package of information. The reason that as officers we've recommended refusal is that these are quite significant parcels of land. They don't have the modelling with them, unlike previous examples that we've had to council. And collectively, strategic planning officers across Southern Tasmanian councils have a preferred view that we continue to push for the review of the regional land use strategy over continual ad hoc amendments. But ultimately, the decision does not sit with this council. We can't veto it. It ultimately sits with the minister.
Thank you. Mayor, my contribution on this will be relatively short and pretty similar to contributions that I've made previously for these amendments. And that is that I absolutely agree that the Strelas is woefully out of date and must be updated with urgency. In the interim, I don't think it's unreasonable for other councils to request amendments to the Strelas, and I don't think that it's fair to penalise those other councils for the delay of the state government in updating the regional land use strategy. And my hope would be that if we encountered a situation where we needed to alter the urban growth boundary or request an amendment to the Strelas, while the exceptionally lengthy process to update it and disappointingly lengthy process to update it is ongoing, I would hope that other councils would support us in putting that amendment before the minister as well. So my support for Glamorgan, Spring Bay and Clarence City Council's request is more on a policy and philosophical basis than the grounds for refusal are, perhaps, but that is my view on the matter. I wouldn't support the recommendation as it stands, and would foreshadow that I would move a motion providing support for these requests as we've done in numerous times past, and I voted in favour of them for much the same reasons as I've just outlined.
Thank you. Further speakers? Councillor Midgley.
Thank you, Mayor. So I know in the past, and correct me if I'm wrong, Mayor, but staff have supported the amendments in the past, as far as I can recall, but for this time we are not supporting it, and I actually do support the conclusion and summary from the staff recommendation, but if they can provide more information in regards to the key points as to why staff at this time are not recommending we support it.
Dr. Stevenson.
Through you, Mayor. So we've had two previous examples. One was a smallish adjustment in Hobart, right on the sort of boundary. So it wasn't many lots, and it was, and they also provided all the extensive reports. You may remember we had a million attachments that went with it, as outlined in the procedure. And similarly, we had a larger one that was Brighton, but it did, again, provide the modelling work, and we don't have that in this case, which is why we didn't support it, because we can't see the impact. Having said that, if council were to determine they, you know, as a gesture of goodwill for other councils, they would like to support it, there are opportunities later on to consider the detail, because it will have to, the Minister, as outlined in, I'm just trying to find the right provision, it does have to come back if the Minister supports it, and so we get a second, here we are, 7.2, so if the proposals proceed, Council will have another opportunity to provide comment at that point. So if the Minister agrees that they support the amendment, it will come back for councils to have another opportunity to comment.
Thank you. And do we know why the modelling and background information wasn't provided at this stage? It's quite a significant development or change.
Dr. Stevenson.
Through you, Mayor, I do understand we received an email today to say, I just had one of those days where I didn't quite get to read all the detail, but my understanding was the commentary was from the not the council, but a developer, to say that the modelling simply doesn't exist. I don't know if any of the... Mayor, do you have a greater recollection of what that email said? No. So I think just the modelling wasn't available is my understanding. But I could take that on notice.
Councillor Cordova.
Thank you, Mayor. I want to express my support where it's due for other municipalities. I want to echo what our constant refrain, which is that the Southern Tasmanian Regional Land Use Strategy is in need of update. I will be supporting the officer's recommendation in this instance because I have been convinced by Dr. Stevenson that there is no strategic analysis of the implications, the potential implications, and really, to me, this all settles on item 8, the risk. For me, there is no risk in saying no at this time because of 7.2. We get another bite at the apple. We get to say what our opinions are later on. But the risk of saying yes to something for which we've got no detail, even if the detail does exist somewhere, I don't have the detail in front of me. I don't have those reports and that modelling and that analysis. So I feel like the risk here, there's very little downside risk in agreeing with the officer's recommendation on this occasion, whereas there is a significant risk in just ad hoc carte blanche giving approval on this occasion. But I do recognise what Councillor Street said, and I also think that, you know, I would hope that municipalities will give us the benefit of the doubt, as we should, where the modelling's available, you know, where the information is there, when it's at our fingertips. So on this occasion, I will be voting in line with the officer's recommendation.
Thank you. sorry, Dr. Stevenson just needs to make a correction to something that she has said.
Well, just to clarify, it will only come back to council in the case that we support it. If we decline to support it, because under the guidelines, it does require that all councils in the southern region agree as part of the process. It's more if we agree and it proceeds to the next step, then it would come back to council. So I just need to clarify that if you accept the motion, it does not necessarily come back.
Further speakers? Councillor Wass.
Yes, thank you, Mayor. I trust Glamorgan Spring Bay to do what's best for their community. They have an issue. It can't be addressed any other way. Hobart had one recently. We supported Hobart. Now, we suggested that we don't support Glamorgan Spring Bay. I would have thought we were a team player and worked with other councils. We all know that the regional land use strategy is deficient. We know that there needs to be changes. But I can't see why we want to rock the boat and create enemies. Because as sure as night follows day, if we wish to have an amendment done, the same will apply to us, and people have long memories. And they would probably turn around and not support us for a change that was necessary that we wanted. Glamorgan Spring Bay has a unique opportunity not only for their municipality, but for the east coast of Tasmania, and yet we're being asked to stand in their way, and I don't support it, and I would certainly second a motion from Councillor Street if this is lost.
Any further speakers? Councillor Cordova.
Just a question. It says at the at the very top of page 192, after it says that it's not been modelled, it says the impacts for Kingborough and the rest of the region are therefore unknown. My question is, what are some examples of what could go wrong?
So the difficulty is that without a holistic land supply picture, are you allowing your growth in the right areas? So you'd be aware that we are doing a lot of work as part of the Greater Hobart Act on our metro plan, and a lot of that is looking at how you increase your density to make your infrastructure reach better, reduce congestion and so forth. So part of what the regional land use strategy does is consider hard and soft infrastructure needs, how you move people between locations. So each time we amend the urban growth boundary, we're adding potential impacts on other council areas, not just the one where the properties are going, which is why we've, you know, had this consistent message. We really need the strategy updated. It's very hard to contemplate, for example, transport impacts in isolation of a regional consideration. So they're the sort of rationales behind wanting the regional land use strategy updated and why it does seek to have that modelling considered. Having said that, if there is support, it still has to go through a planning commission process and so forth. So it's not an absolute. It's whether we, as a council, we're prepared to let it go to the next step. And as I said, from an officer's point of view, this was not anything more than there had been some conversation across councils about that we really would prefer this was all done through the regional land use strategy and keeping the pressure up there. But from my perspective over this area, if council were to say, we're prepared to support it, to be part of a regional team player, and we'll have a look at the detail when it comes back, I'm not going to get upset.
Just one more follow-up question, with your indulgence, ma'am.
Sure.
So in the case of the Clarence Council request, and I could be reading it wrong, but my understanding is that the proponent is essentially alleging that there isn't any data available to model land supply and sequencing at a regional level. So can you please clarify
if that data doesn't exist, what was the response to if the data doesn't exist? Because I think that was the issue.
Dr. Stevenson.
So that's really what needs to be done as part of the next iteration of the regional land use strategy. So we have pockets of data. So we've done quite a lot, for example, around the Greater Hobart, the Metro Council's planning. But otherwise it's quite dated because it dates back to when the original strategy was written.
Thank you. My final question is, if I'm understanding it right, the choice is, do we just accept in an ad hoc fashion to kind of just do it blind, so to speak, without the data, or do we really put our foot down and insist that we want to have that data so that we know where the hard and soft infrastructure should be? Is that a correct analysis?
Dr. Stevenson.
Through you, Mayor. I think, in theory, we would want to understand the impacts that might trickle to Kingborough. Now, obviously, these councils are a fair way from us, so there may not be a direct impact on our municipality. So this is really a theoretical argument in this sense. Council can determine that really that's ultimately the role of the Planning Commission in considering the planning scheme. The planning policy unit in providing advice to the minister may do that work, and that's why they've developed these guidelines. And the guidelines do say that there needs to be a land supply and demand for the region in its entirety, and so ultimately the minister could take that into account. And if we wanted to say, okay, look, in principle we've got some concerns around the data, and then the minister ultimately is responsible for that in-depth consideration.
Thank you. Further speakers? Otherwise, I will put the motion as printed on page 192 of the agenda. It was moved by Councillor Fox, seconded by Councillor Midgley. Oh, sorry, Councillor Fox, did you want to sum up? Beg your pardon.
Yes, I would. Thank you. I guess what I'm looking at the author of this report, and that's Adrian Stander, our strategic planner, and I think from his professional point of view, looking after a council's interest, it's important that we don't make decisions without background information, and I think that's really the bottom line here. We're in a real conundrum, aren't we? If we say no, we don't get the information, and if we say yes, we're damned because we've agreed to it without the information. So it's a very difficult position for us to be in. I'm not going to argue either way. I'll just leave it in the hands of the good councillors.
Of which you are one, by the way. Thank you, Councillor Fox. Okay, so I will move the motion now. Put the motion as moved by Councillor Fox, seconded by Councillor Midgley. All those in favour?
Aye.
Against?
Aye.
The motion is lost. Beg your pardon, a division, sorry. A division. So all those in favour? Is Councillors Cordova, Midgley and Fox. Those against? Is Councillors Wass, Gladewright, Street, Bastone, Westwood and Reet. I guess we can't do anything further with this now because we don't... Somebody want to move... beg your pardon, you foreshadowed. Yeah. Thank you, Councillor Street.
And I'm just going to look around the room while I'm doing this to see whether I get this right. So the motion that I would move is that while council maintains concerns around the level of detail provided with the requests of Glamorgan Spring Bay Council and Clarence City Council, it provides support...
Hang on, wait for Mrs. Morton.
Sorry, Mrs. Morton. It provides support for the requests to amend the Southern Tasmanian Regional Land Use Strategy in principle.
two instead of four.
Instead of four, yeah. So it provides support to the requests by Glamorgan Spring Bay Council and Clarence City Council. To the requests by Glamorgan Spring Bay
fine.
Council. Is that sufficient?
Yep.
Yeah. Well, I mean, look, we could, or I'm on indulgence here, Dr. Stevenson, but am I taking it too far to include a statement regarding the ridiculous delay in updating the Strelas?
Dr. Stevenson.
Through you, Mayor. We already have a motion previously in that regard, and this goes to the councils, not the minister.
In other words, we've gone far enough.
Yeah.
Okay.
Excellent. So moved.
Do I have a seconder for that, Councillor Gladright? Speakers on the amended motion, on the new motion?
I think my reasons for moving the motion have been
Thank
made
you.
Clear in my previous.
Thank you. Any further speakers? Otherwise, I'll put the new motion. It's moved by Councillor Reid, Councillor Street, seconded by Councillor Gladright. While Council maintains concerns around the level of detail provided with the requests of Glamorgan Spring Bay Council and Clarence City Council, it provides support to the requests to amend Southern Tasmanian Regional Land Use Strategy in principle. All those in favour? Against? I'll have a division. All those in favour? Is Councillors Wass, Midgley, Gladright, Street, Westwood and Reet, Bastone, Westwood and Reet. At least you didn't call yourself another name. And those against is Councillors Cordova and Fox. The motion is passed. Thank you. Moving to page 197, we have the draft Kingborough Cycling Strategy for 2021 to 2030. Do I have a mover of the motion? Councillor Midgley and seconded by Councillor Fox. Councillor Midgley.
Thank you, Mayor. And I look to Councillor Fox if she wanted to move this because I acknowledge that she was the chair of the Kingborough Bicycle Advisory Committee when the start of this happened and has been there for a longer term than myself. So thank you, Councillor Fox, for, being at the start of this strategy development. And chairing the meetings in regards to getting that along. I'd also like to acknowledge staff Anthony Vidal and David Reid for their time and work in getting this moving along and liaising with the many now big group of KBAC members and the Institute for Sensible Transport to ensure that everybody was happy that this document come to Council. I note that Sensible Transport, as it says in the report, they rode around with KBAC members. I think I spent about a day and a half riding around Kingborough. It was great to show off the many lacking cycling facilities and kind of safety, not so safe places to ride around Kingborough, but also dreaming up the many possible routes and actually even riding along Algona Road. I didn't realise how much space there was along the side there and that possibility of a shared path. So it really gave me some insight. And they were really really great details and knowledge and experience in designing strategies for many other local government areas. So thanks to the KBAC members who provided comments and thoughts to the draft. As we can see in the report, that this basically is a draft document that goes to the public for a community engagement process. I look forward to seeing the engagement process and the community's response to that. So that's what we're approving tonight at Council. So I won't go too much into the details of the highlights, leave that for some other councillors. But basically, as a summary on the Kingborough Bicycle, the Kingborough Cycling Strategy 2021-2030 seeks to make cycling an attractive choice for more people, whether for recreation or transport, and the strategy identifies a range of infrastructure upgrades, advocacy actions, policies and programs to help make Kingborough an even better place to cycle. So it's not for all the, you know, the strategy isn't aimed at all the Lycra cyclists, about cycling for the, I think it says like the 70% there, or a whole variety of people to cycle. And I think, and you've heard me since I've been on council, always raising cycling and active transport as a really important matter, because we are a growing municipality, and if we are looking at congestion busting, cycling, scooters, you know, it's all related, and walking is one of the ways that we can look at reducing our car use. And the growth of electric bikes means that it's so important to have this strategy for the future. And I'm really interested and excited that so many councillors around the room are taking a bit of an interest in e-bikes as well.
Councillor Street.
And it's also really great. You can see the action plan and implementation. So it really highlights the projects that we have from the different scale of projects. And I think what happens, so what happens around government is they have some money for cycling that sometimes pops out of, we don't know where it comes from, but we've got now a great plan for shovel-ready projects that we can pitch and apply to government because we've had a really great structure and plan in place. So I hope that you can all support this going out for community engagement, and I look forward to the community response to this.
Thank you, Councillor Midgley. Do I have further speakers? Councillor Cordova.
Thank you, Mayor. What a terrific report, and a testament to the great interest and also the hard work of so many people who helped put it together. For me, the take-home message here is this. Only 6% of people say that they feel confident riding on a road in traffic without bicycle infrastructure. When provided with protected bicycle lanes separated from motor vehicles, 83% of people say they feel confident. This report provides us with the blueprint, the roadmap, for getting good bicycle infrastructure. And what it reveals and illuminates is that there is a huge proportion of people in our municipality who, given the chance, would be on a bike, and that would have enormous health and wellbeing benefits for them as individuals, for the community, and of course it would pay dividends when it comes to our health expenditure. 86% of Kingborough residents drive even when the trip is 5 kilometres or less. That is an indictment of a lack of infrastructure that currently exists, but what this report is testament to our interest in the subject and commitment to doing more on it. I really hope that we now put the money that is required in order to enact some of these recommendations, but I'm thrilled to bits with the sophistication of the analysis. So when it comes to this kind of geospatial analysis, the Bike Use Propensity Index, basically they've crunched a whole bunch of data from the 2016 census, that is the residential population density of a given area, the employment density, the density of young adults, the low motor vehicle ownership areas, bicycle use in those areas, and they basically computed all that data, put it together and created maps of where we should have more bicycle infrastructure. So it gives us a way forward, a triage, if you will, to know where we should do first and what kind of road cycling or other bicycle infrastructure is necessary. I think I think that the report is fascinating. It's well worth a read, and it really is an important opportunity for, as was mentioned by Councillor Midgley, we now have essentially shovel-ready projects that we can go out to get funding for, that we can point to this document and say, we're ready, we've done the groundwork, and now we're ready to receive that funding in order to implement these strategies. So more power to cyclists in Kingborough. There's this enormous proportion of people, 83% of people who would be on the bike, and I'm one of that cohort of 83% who I would be cycling a lot more if I felt more confident in amongst traffic, and the way to make me feel confident is to separate me from that traffic. So the more cycling infrastructure we can get, the better we'll be and the healthier we'll all become. So thank you once again.
Thank you, Councillor Cordova. Councillor Fox.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mayor, I guess I've been involved with cycling since probably more than 30 years, but I'm one of those people who are getting a bit frail and elderly, and I don't want to ride my bike anymore. And I'm hoping that this strategy will allow for people like me to hop on their bikes again, because the health benefits of riding bikes are enormous to people of all ages, as long as they don't get run over by a car. And I think that the report doesn't actually acknowledge the fact that the finance for this report actually comes from the congestion busting state government funds. Perhaps Mr. Reid could confirm that. Because I think over the years it's taken us so long to get this strategy and there's gone so much work's been put in it, but the funding, could you confirm please, Mr. Reid, through you, Madam Chair?
Yeah, that's correct. So through the city deal funding there, they also put some money aside to actually start this process. And I guess we'll also be looking in the future for funding sources either through the city deal or through other funding sources to actually start to implement actions that are in the bike plan as well once it's endorsed.
Well, that's what it's all about. So politically, I think at all levels of government, people are now acknowledging the importance of cycling and the health benefits and the community benefits of getting people on their bikes and making people safer on their bikes, but also making cars more responsive to the needs of other people in the community. So congratulations to everyone involved, including Councillor Midgley, who's taken up the baton and run with it. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Councillor Fox. Councillor Walls.
Thank you, Mayor. I support the strategy. What I would like to see, however, is when this draft strategy comes back after community consultation, I'd like to see a further report, or two further reports actually, one on the local community trails, in other words, what ones can be put together, particularly for young primary school children going to schools, because there are a lot of primary school children that live very close and with the local community trails are there in a matter of no time. And the second one, in the draft strategy, there is a photo of an electric scooter, but electric scooters are silent. And I think we've got to recognise that they are coming. The only thing that we need to know is the time. The parts of the world where electric scooters are now normal is growing every day. They are becoming a new way of people getting around, and particularly as Councillor Fox indicates, those are a bit frail. They're tending to be ridden as well, and I think we need to look at it a whole system, not just one area. But I do support the draft strategy, but I think we need to, when we discuss it next time, is to open it up and expand it a little bit so that we're working towards one common goal, not just cycling, because if we do that and then we work on another one, we're just going to overlap everything that we do and it will be more costly.
Thank you, Councillor Walls. Councillor Glade-Wright.
Thank you. I'd just like to know what the consultation will look like, please.
Mr. Reeve.
Yeah, so we've put together a survey there that we'll send out to people to gather information about the report, things that they like about the report, things they might not like about the report, other things they'd like to see in the report as well, and then we'll go through a process of making any sort of any changes or recommended changes that might be necessary in consultation with KBAC as well, who've been, I might do this plug for KBAC because they've done a lot of work on this particular document as well. They're the ones who actually initiated this document there and did most of that, and I think they should be congratulated for that as well. But they will certainly have some input into that process as well with the feedback from the consultation, and then we'll obviously collate all that together and bring that back to council there and then with a finalised document.
Thank you. Any further speakers? If not, I'll just make a brief contribution, and that was just to say that I think this is a great step forward, and I did want to acknowledge the tremendous amount of work that has been put into this over a long period of time by Councillor Fox, taken over now by Councillor Midgley, but all the members of the Bicycle Advisory Committee as well, who have been very passionate advocates for providing additional whether it be shared pathways or discrete cycle lanes, and I totally understand the bit about being a confident cyclist, because I'm not a confident one, but I found myself when I've travelled in places where there are separated bike lanes, you realise what an enjoyable and great way it is to get around and just do your day-to-day business and whilst contributing to your health. And so when I've been in places like Europe where you have that luxury. It just feels natural and the thing to do to get on your bike. And I did really enjoy cycling around Kingborough, and also took my bike up into Hobart last year when we were in lockdown and you're allowed out for your hour of exercise because there were no cars on the road. And all of a sudden I found myself wanting to go out on the bike more because there were no cars and I felt confident, whereas in any other situation I'm one of those ones who sits at the traffic lights and thinks, please don't fall over on her bike. clearly, and I also would really like Santa to bring me an e-bike, but I think that's a very big ask. I think that it's something that is, as Ben said, is increasing in popularity, and we need to recognise that. And it's terrific that we now have a framework where when there are funding opportunities that come up, and we are, of course, in the lead-up to a federal election, whenever that might be, there are things that we can now take, as Councillor Midgley said, that are shovel-ready and enthusiastically say, hey, listen, look what we've got here that can benefit many people within our community. So looking forward to this going out to public consultation and endorse it as well. Councillor Midgley, did you want to sum up? No? In that case, I'll put the motion that the draft Kingborough Cycling Strategy 2021-2030 be endorsed for community consultation. It's moved by Councillor Midgley, seconded by Councillor Fox. All those in favour?
Aye.
Against? Motion is carried unanimously. Moving on now to page 262, the election caretaker period policy, with a recommendation on page 264. Do I have a mover, please? Councillor Westwood and a seconder in Councillor Midgley. Councillor Westwood.
Thank you, Mayor. The report we have before us is ask Council to endorse an election period policy. And these types of policies are commonly referred to as caretaker provisions. It is commonplace across all levels of government, although not at a local government level in Tasmania, to have a policy position around a caretaker period. A caretaker period is the period immediately preceding an election, and the purpose of a caretaker period is to prevent the incumbent government from making binding decisions that will impact the way a future government can operate. So council obviously is a little bit different to state and federal governments because we have 10 elected representatives. But there are, in certain situations, decisions that could potentially bind an incoming group of 10 councillors to a decision that had been made by their former elected representatives that may not align with the views of the new group of elected representatives. So the three objectives of the policy as drafted is to ensure that major policy decisions are not made by council in the lead up to an election that would prove binding for an incoming council. Council resources are not used for the advantage of a candidate in a local government general election, and the requirement to act impartially in relation to all candidates standing for election is clearly understood. This has been looked at and I believe will be actioned at some point in time as part of the review of the Local Government Act, but in lieu of waiting for that to happen, in terms of good governance and open, transparent operations of council in the lead up to the next election, which is due at the end of next year, I think it would be prudent for our council to lead the way. So I'm not aware of another Tasmanian council that has such a policy. Lead the way in terms of setting a good example and sending a clear message that we do expect that we will all act in the best interests of the community in making decisions in the period immediately preceding that election, and that we will not use our council resources for the advantage of a particular candidate, whether that be ourselves or another candidate. So I would ask my colleagues to support the policy as drafted, and I thank staff for bringing it to council in such a speedy fashion.
Thank you. Councillor Bastone and then Councillor Cordova.
Thank you. I have some questions on the procedure, the policy detail. 5.1.2, tenders and contracts. No contract shall be approved for which the total sum exceeds 1% of the council's revenue. Can I have an approximate idea about how much that is?
Mr. Breen.
Through you, Mayor, around about $450,000.
Okay. All right. In 5.1.7, use of council stationeries. Business cards or other council branded material shall not be used by councillors or staff for electoral activities. Now, as a councillor, does this mean that the minute that the election is called, I cannot use my council card?
Business card?
My business card, which I would normally give out to people, not as an election thing, but I would be giving it out just normally.
That is an interesting question, Mr. Smee.
Through you, Mayor, no, the policy would not restrict you from doing that. It refers specifically to electoral activities, and the policy quite clearly states that councillors can continue to engage with their constituents as normal, but the handing out of business cards or other council branded material that is specifically in relation to your election campaign is what this policy aims to prohibit.
And I'm just wondering who's going to say what I'm doing is part of an election campaign or part of my normal everyday life as a councillor. I just find that one not very comfortable at all, not being able to, or having someone say I'm using my business cards as part of an electoral campaign. I do have a worry about that, and I'd like that removed.
Okay,
I have more. Councillors, where is it? Council funded telephones, computers and vehicles may not be used by councillors or staff in any manner that supports a council election campaign. I have a council computer. Does this mean I cannot use it during the campaign?
Mr. Smee.
Through you, Mayor, again, no. The normal business of councillors will continue, and their use of any council-provided equipment for normal councillor use is permitted to continue. But using that equipment for part of an election campaign, again, is what this policy endeavours to crack down on.
Can I ask just a clarification on your question, on your answer? So, if you've got a laptop supplied by council, I'm reading this in the same way that Councillor Bastone is, and that is that you are not allowed to use that during election campaign. Surely that's not the intent. So that if somebody writes to one of us during an election campaign, that we can't write back using a council-supplied laptop?
And
because that's what it says.
And part of this also is that there are some councillors who have part of their phone bills paid by the council. Does this mean they could not claim their phone bills during an election campaign?
No, so the difference is...
Thank you, Mayor. Go for it.
The difference is that, so for example, you shouldn't use your council provided laptop to develop your flyers for your election campaign. You wouldn't be doing cold calling to say, please vote for me from your council phone. That's the difference.
That's a good election strategy.
You wouldn't hand out your business card when you're door knocking to say, please vote for me. So it's when you're actively campaigning, not when you're doing your council business.
So how do you, if somebody comes up to you, if you're at an event and it's during election campaign period and somebody says, oh, I want to talk to you about your thoughts on such and such, and you say, please ring me, and you hand them your business card, that could be misinterpreted.
Exactly. This is what I'm worried. I just think that there's a very grey area in these things.
I see it about being your formalised campaign activities, not responding to individual queries. So door knocking, distribution of materials, dedicated calling, you know, so actual formalised campaign activities, not just incidental engagement with people in the community. It's to really, the policy is designed to avoid the systematic use of equipment in the same way that in state government, when I was in there, you couldn't use your state government computer to develop your election materials, you couldn't use your state government email to distribute them, those sorts of things if you were running. So it's really about that formalised campaigning, not your day-to-day interactions.
Okay.
Well, I hope that helps clarify the intent of the policy.
I understand, but I'm still feeling that there's going to be some very grey areas in this. 5.1.11 or 11, councillors shall not use their membership of a council advisory committee, that's fine, or appointment as a member of an external group to disseminate information or promote their or any other candidate's election campaign. What sort of external group are you talking about there?
Dr. Stevenson, through you, Mayor. So there are a range of appointments that can be made. For example, the Legat delegate or a representative on a ministerial advisory council type thing, or you know, those formal council appointments that are made through council decision making processes.
Thank you.
Daniel will hopefully correct me if I've got it wrong.
Nothing further. I had Councillor Cordover, then Councillor Street.
Thank you, Mayor. I will be moving a couple of amendments. The first, let me start by saying there's a question, which is why the policy, it says in the, it says that the adoption or renewal of policies won't happen. So this is at 2.1 in the definitions on page 265, about halfway down the page. It says a major policy decision includes adoption or renewal of policies. Why was that included?
Mr. Smee.
Through you, Mayor, because an adoption of a new policy then potentially binds the incoming council to a policy decision. So during that caretaker period, and again, this is standard for councils on the mainland, they do not adopt policies during that caretaker period because of that fact that a policy can exist for the next 4 years and you are then binding that new council as a result of adopting that policy during the few weeks in the lead up to the election.
Thank you. That makes perfect sense to me. Is it not true, though, that a policy can be changed at any time, even when it's not up for review at the prerogative of councillors?
Mr. Smee.
That is correct. That is correct. However, I think good governance would say that it's better simply to delay the adoption of a new policy until the new council is on board rather than have the existing council adopt a new policy, which then the new council has to then amend or overturn a few months later.
Thank you. I'm convinced by that argument. I'm convinced by that. That's fine. So I'm happy to leave in the policy bit. I think that what we've been talking about, and I'm glad that Councillor Bastone raises this, and it was clarified, I think, by Dr. Stevenson by saying this is to avoid the systemic use of equipment and logos and things like that. I think it needs to either say systemic use, and because it doesn't, I'm going to move an amendment. And the reason why I'm going to move an amendment to remove just 5.1.7, and I'm happy to hear the debate around this, because I think the intention is right, that you don't want people systemically using, let's say, their business card instead of printing up your own flyers. You don't want people giving out 5,000 business cards across Kingborough and then saying, can I have some more business cards, please, and essentially using council to fund their campaign. That's clear to me.
Not a good idea.
It doesn't say it doesn't say systemic use, and what I think this is potentially an invitation for complaints and ambushes where you'll get supporters of one candidate asking a sitting councillor, oh, can I have your contact details on the hustings, and then making a report to council and saying, and we have this every year with the poster wars as well, that, you know, you get people deliberately and kind of in a very over-the-top way policing posters. Now, that there's a good intention behind the posters. I'm not trying to say that, but I think we are welcoming a whole raft of kind of vexatious and needless time-wasting of the council, and to police the resourcing over $2 worth of business cards, it's going to cost us a lot of time and headache for potentially decades to come. So because of that risk of ambushes and over-the-top complaints, and I think that
vexatious.
Risk... Shall we say vexatious? I don't see that the benefit that we're going to get is anywhere near the kind of headache that it will cause, and so I'm going to move an amendment to 5.1.7 simply to remove it, unless somebody would like to convince me that we should somehow try and fiddle with it to include that systemic use. But then you need a definition of systemic use, and, you know, I just want to remove 5.1.7, please.
Okay. Who do I have next on my list? Councillor Street.
Amendment now?
Oh, if you... I thought you just foreshadowed it. Okay, so the amendment is to remove 5.1.7. It is moved by Councillor Cordova, seconded by Councillor Midgley. All those in favour of... Oh, does anyone speak to the amendment?
Where are we up to?
Sorry. Oh, sorry, I beg your pardon. Sorry. Tell we've been going for 3 hours. Seconded by Councillor Bastone. Do you want to speak? What?
Sorry. I thought the mover and the seconder have to agree to move it, to amend it. No? Is that different? No? Okay, sorry.
Okay.
So just to speak to it briefly, the systemic issue here, I think the intention of the policy that we've now elucidated as a result of this conversation is to avoid systemic use of, or systemic misuse, I should say, of the council logo and letterheads and emblems and business cards. But what I'm trying to make the point is that we have that policy, this policy as it's written, does not talk about systemic misuse of council stuff, and we know that councillors do talk to a lot of people in the community, and it's a very grey, blurred line as to what counts as during those 6 or 7 weeks of the election period. If somebody is holding your business card, does that count as you lobbying them for your vote, or does that count as you having a chat to them? And unless we kind of build that out and flesh that out, which I'm more than happy to do in the interests of, you know, having a really transparent and having a really transparent policy, this policy as written doesn't say what I think the intention was. Thank you.
Thank you. Councillor Street?
Thank you, Mayor. Look, I understand where Councillor Cordova's coming from. I don't want to throw the baby out with the bathwater on this, because my fear is that in having it in the draft policy and then removing it entirely, look, I'm not suggesting that there would be tacit approval of the use of those things, but I don't want there to be any suggestion that it was excluded so they could be used. And I certainly think, I understand the argument around business cards, absolutely, but logos and emblems are really important in terms of perception during campaigning, and that must stay in my view. I'd be far happier to look at an amendment along the lines that you've actually foreshadowed, Councillor Cordova, and turning that part of the policy... How do we draw it back a little bit? I haven't had sufficient time to consider that, and I'm trying to think about it in my head. I suppose the trouble is that the logos and the emblems aren't on the business cards.
Yeah.
And Dr. Stevenson might have a suggestion. So what's your suggestion, Dr. Stevenson?
I hope Dr. Stevenson has a suggestion.
Through you, Mayor, I wonder if you could just add the word formal. For formal electoral activities, And you could even then put in the definition under electoral activities things like door knocking, production of flyers. I'm wondering if that might... So we're actually linking all of those provisions which talk about electoral activities to a definition or some examples that make it understood that it's about those formal campaigning type activities.
She's nailed it.
She has. My only difficulty is that
how to put that into
now we're going to amend that part of the policy, and we're also going to add a definition on the run.
So do we want to, can I suggest a way around this, that it might be that we defer this to redraft those words to get them right?
I think probably in the interest of getting the deferred policy right, on indulgence, Mayor, I think perhaps if we could wait until everybody has spoken.
I was going to say that, because then we've got some further
guidance.
Whoever's
last out can shut the door, as it were.
Any further speakers? Councillor Fox and then Councillor Gladright.
When I first read this document, I thought the most critical line is probably the last in the conclusion. And this is guidance only, and it's for the organisation and councillors and staff. And I think it's good governance, but at the same time, there is no legislation that enforces this, and it's not legally enforceable. So it seems like a good idea, and I guess we're doing this in good faith, and it's good principle, but it's unenforceable. So we can fiddle at the edges and get it perfect and get it right, because we are setting an example, and who knows, it might be taken up by the local government association as a blueprint, and I think we should get it right, but we don't want to get too tied up about it either.
Thank you, Councillor Fox. Councillor Gladright.
Thank you. If you're adding some more definitions, I'd like to see the definition of significant decisions that appears in 1.2 in the policy statement. There's a definition there for major policy decision, but I'd like to see the definition of significant decisions added. And then I just had a question, just playing devil's advocate. What about the case of if there's a series of by-elections? We all started dropping off from a pandemic or something and there was a series.
Jeez, you're uplifting for this time of night. So it doesn't apply to by-elections.
Right, okay. Sorry, forgive me, I take that back.
And hopefully we're all double jabbed. So
yeah. Okay. All right, I think that's it then. Thank you.
Are there any further contributions? If not, just... Oh, Councillor Bastone.
Sorry, I have one more. I use my own private phone number as my council phone number, and I will be putting that on any flyer, but I'm not sure it says use of council contacts. Council telephone numbers and email addresses should not be used. Well, if I'm using my own private phone... I presume that's all right. Is that right? Even though it's on the council website as my contact phone. Right?
Yeah. Okay. Councillor Street.
I assume we're still on the amendment.
Quite possibly, yes.
look, regardless, mine is just a question. And probably one for consideration when the policy comes back, just in relation to 5.1.3, has any consideration been given to how that will operate with the statutory timeframes?
Dr. Stevenson.
Through you, Mayor, because it only relates to the really big items like a planning scheme amendment and so forth, they won't be impacted by a six-week caretaker period. So it's not all planning decisions, it's just big ticket ones.
So not your regular DA.
Yeah, so don't have the same statutory timeframes around them necessarily, like our local provision schedule.
So. Okay. Yep. Now, Councillor Midgley.
Thank you. I have a quick question about telephones as well. The So it may be because I use private phone, council phone, same number. Can we just delete council telephone? Can it just be email addresses? Because so many of us have one phone that we use.
Can it just be what, sorry, email addresses?
Rather than it saying council telephone numbers, it just says council email addresses, and we just delete
what,
the telephone
what number
numbers.
Are you at?
5.1.9. Otherwise, I don't know how the discrepancy around the council telephone numbers when many of us only have the one.
I've got to say, I mean, I've got a problem with the council saying you can't use your council email address because... that's the one that people are used to contacting you on. So all of a sudden then you give another email address and you're going to, and then, you know, that's, yeah, for what purpose? I don't quite understand.
I did at the last election. I got a new email address, florafox@tpg.com.
Thank you
and
for that infomercial.
I publicised
Do we
I
get free steak
that
on?
Instead of my council one.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm not sure. It's not like email costs something. Like, it's not a resource thing. Well, but... I mean, I know we did have a situation where we had a former councillor after they were no longer a councillor who still used a councillor email address. Like, put councillor in front of their name to... which was not obviously not appropriate, but I find this one a bit curious as well.
Through you, Mayor, it's not about the cost, it's about the benefit that incumbency provides. So if you're signalling that you're already a councillor, you're giving
it's a fact.
But the whole policy is about trying to reduce the benefit of being a current councillor during an election campaign. So I understand that. It's ultimately your call. But that is the rationale for having that in there. It's about trying to reduce the impact of your incumbency that gives you an advantage. So
I understand that, but obviously...
Councillor Bastone.
Sorry.
And then Councillor Gladwright.
But obviously my flyer is going to say... current serving councillor.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not going to pretend I'm not a councillor so that I give everyone else an equal chance. No way, mate. So.
Thank you for your honesty, Councillor Bastone. Councillor Gladwright.
I just wanted to clarify. So if we get someone email us on our councillor, to our councillor email address, we then have to jump onto another email to respond to them.
That's...
if it's related to... you know, related to inviting them to the whatever it is.
We've so gone down the rabbit hole, haven't we?
Through you, Mayor, yes. I think everyone's overthinking it.
Yeah.
What you wouldn't do from your councillor email is send out a bulk email, please vote for me, to hundreds of people.
Well...
your councillor email address, no.
Well, you see, no, that's where I think it gets... yeah, no... given it's 8:30 and we're clearly so far down this rabbit hole now, I do believe that there was a... oh, we haven't dealt with the amendment yet. Okay, we've got to deal with the amendment, which was moved by Councillor Cordova and seconded by Councillor Bastone to remove 5.1.7 from the policy. Did you want...
can I sum up briefly?
Yes, you can.
Thank you, Mayor. The intention is so good, and we need to avoid... we need to defend against and have good governance and defend against the systemic misuse, you know, fraud, the cost to council. Absolutely. What we're looking at here is a policy which, whilst it might be the template that's used by state governments all over the country, or indeed municipalities in Victoria, to me it's overreach. It's to be doubling up on email addresses, to be doubling up on contact telephones, to not have your council email address on a flyer that you produce. What are we defending against? What council resources are being consumed or misused by that? The intention was supposed to be about systemic misuse, and instead we're here haggling over something that I think will cause so much more of a headache than is necessary, because it is the pursuit of bureaucratic minutiae
as opposed to trying to deal with good governance, which is what we're all about. You know, I believe in good governance and I believe in integrity, and the wording of this, whilst it might be a template from elsewhere, does not to me feel appropriate. To me, it feels like it will encourage sophistry, where people...
Encourage what?
Encourage sophistry, as in people saying that, well, my
Sorry,
council...
what does that mean?
It means... what does it mean? The use,
you can't use a word you don't know what it means.
This is what it means. The use of clever but false arguments, especially with the intention of deceiving. And what I mean by that is, if you say that this is my council phone, but it's actually my private phone, but I wasn't on the hustings when I was talking to you, even though you were, it's the kind of the meaningless encouragement of bureaucratic... doublespeak. It's sophistry. It's not worth it. It's not worth it. This policy, this aspect of this policy is overreach, when in fact we should be focusing on those things like the policies, the spending of $450,000. Isn't that incredible that in this entire debate we focused on the phone numbers and the email addresses rather than the main point, which is that during an election period you shouldn't be passing $1 million worth of stuff on the council. That I agree with. So that's what this amendment is aimed to avoid. Let's get rid of the minutiae aspects, the fiddly little bits.
I know what that means.
And let's focus on the million-dollar projects, and that's where the good governance comes in.
Thank you for that summation. So we have the amendment that I'll just now put. It's moved by Councillor Cordova, seconded by Councillor Bastine, to remove 5.1.7 from the policy. Just to remind people that we're probably heading towards a deferral of this. So then my advice would be to not support, to vote against this, so that we're then dealing with the entire thing at another time. So I'll put the motion. All those in favour?
Aye.
Okay. And those against? No. Show of hands, please. Those in favour? Councillors Cordova, Fox and Bastone. Those against? Councillors Wass, Midgley, Gladewright. Have you got your hand up? Councillor Street? Councillor Street. I'm not trying to tell you how to vote, but Councillor Westwood and Councillor Reid. So the motion is lost, and a little bit of perspective that we're heading towards rapidly, it seems, 9 o'clock, and we've been stuck on this for a while. Do I have any motion to defer this? I have a motion from Councillor Midgley and a seconder in Councillor Bastone. Councillor Midgley, would you like to speak to the deferral? You don't have to. You can, if I'm not stifling debate.
I need to state what the motion is.
No? Oh, sorry, procedural. Beg your pardon. Thank you, sorry. Okay, that the matter be deferred, moved by Councillor Midgley, seconded by Councillor Bastone. All those in favour? Against? The motion is carried unanimously. Okay, moving on to community grants. We have a recommendation on page 269. Do I have a mover and a seconder, please? A mover in Councillor Fox, a seconder in Councillor Street. Councillor Fox.
It's interesting that we've had less applicants than we have money to distribute at this point, or less applicants that comply with the rules, basically. And that there is a proposal that we have another round later in the year. There are some excellent projects which have been brought forward to us, and I recommend agreeing with all of them that have come to us. Those who've been outside the guidelines have not received the money, or other reasons not necessarily given. With the recommendation is that $11,260 is actually distributed. The request for money was $32,000, which shows you that two-thirds of them were not successful. But perhaps with more information or different applications, it might be possible to put the rest of that money back into the community later in the year. Thank you.
Thank you, Councillor Fox. I've got Councillor Bastone and then Councillor Midgley.
Mine's just a very brief question. Are we able to be told why some of these grants did not go ahead?
Dr. Stevenson.
Through you, Mayor. The most common reason was there were two common ones. They were either applying for operational funds, which is not within the guidelines, or they were not Kingborough-based organisations, so which also not within the guidelines. So they might have been holding an event here, but they were actually running... So, for example, Tasmania Multiple Births Association was one that is not based in Kingborough.
Okay, but West Winds Community Centre was for establishment, so not for the ongoing, and it's certainly part of Kingborough.
I'd have to go and look at the West Winds one. There was a reason, and I need to go... Oh, yeah, if I could have a look. Thank you, Mr. Smee has reminded me. It was they didn't have any funding. They hadn't got the other rest of the funding lined up, and so that was why.
Thank you. I'll speak to them about it.
Any further speakers? Councillor Midgley.
Thank you, Mayor, and I note that it is late. Community grants are a very big passion of mine, and I have chatted to Dr. Stevenson about one in particular. The Friends of Kingston Library, I think that was a really great project targeting sensory for children with disabilities, and I'm not sure at all. I think I asked this in a few times if council staff would follow up on such initiatives like this, because it does seem like I haven't seen something come across the grants application table since I've been on council. If you want to provide any explanation in regards to that, I'm through you, Mayor. Dr. Stevenson.
Thank you, Mayor. Yes, I am happy. We had quite a considerable conversation about who was the appropriate funder for something out of the library, and we did not think it was council. We felt it should be funded by the Department of Education. The library is their domain.
Okay, thank you. The Kingston community, I don't want to go through every single one, but I just hope that in regards to some of the, I guess, the reasons why we hadn't funded it, like the Kingston Community Garden, we know during COVID that, you know, growing seeds, growing plants has been such a growth, and we want to activate the community garden and make the community aware of that. I don't know if there's any way that we can have conversations or perhaps look at how they can apply for the grant to make it eligible for next time. That's just a comment on that. The wheelchair compliant regarding that's, I mean, that's a really significant and important matter as well. Again, perhaps it's not an applicable grant that they applied for in regards to that, but maybe we can make them aware of some other grants that they might be able to apply for the sailing club to make that ramp compliant, because it is...
Yeah.
Oh, that one was funded. Oh,
yeah,
sorry.
That one was funded.
Sorry,
yeah.
Excuse me. I wrote that it wasn't on what I... Sorry, excuse me about that.
Yep.
Oh, the West... I know the West, sorry. Excuse me. The WEF, that's great that it was funded.
And yeah. the Kingston Community Garden one has been partially funded.
Yes. The West Winds Garden, sorry, that wasn't funding, and the Margate one, was that, did that at all fit with, say, the funds that are put aside for the KWS in regards to the recycling projects and things like that? I'm wondering, especially in regards to the Margate funding.
Dr. Stevenson.
Through you, Mayor. The Margate Primary School was a similar discussion as the Friends of the Library, in that this is really a project that benefits the school, and so we felt it should be funded by the Department of Education rather than taking the community grant funding. West Winds, as I provided the comment to Councillor Bastone before, they didn't meet the criteria around their other funding.
The matched funding, yeah. Yes. And but in regards to the Margate, I'm wondering at all, through you, Mayor, Mr. Reeve and I have had conversations in regards to there being possible funds available through KWS regarding school recycling type projects and waste awareness type projects, and community gardens can be such a great example of waste awareness projects where they put the food waste and compost into the garden and that kind of thing. I don't know if at all that could be a follow-up conversation with KWS and Mr. Reeve in regards to that.
Dr. Stevenson?
Through you, Mayor, I just want to clarify. With the Margate one, they wanted a particular piece of equipment, this chipper, and so it was just a piece of equipment that didn't necessarily seem to have any ongoing link or relationship to the broader community, only to the school. So, yeah. But
Mr. Reeve, looks like you're in the hot seat. Much to his surprise.
There is the garden, concept garden that we already have up at the Beretta site at the moment there, which we do have someone who comes in on a regular basis here and provides information about that. So we've already set that up already. We have set up a number of other different things that we're looking at as well. When I say we, I'm talking about KWS. And we'd also be looking at, you know, other opportunities to try and provide additional education out there to people, and we've sort of discussed that as a board and looked at that in terms of our own budgeting process there, in terms of what we can add in or not add in, as the case may be. We know that we'll be running the schools program fairly shortly, and we believe that there may be some things that might come out of that process as well that schools may want to put forward as initiatives as well that we can look at. So there is a number of different things that are possible out there, and certainly quite happy to work in this space there. Clearly we've sort of covered off on a number of the larger type initiatives there, such as FOGO and so forth there, and it's really now looking at some of these other initiatives as well at the same time and trying to get some of that education actually out there. So yes, more than happy, I think I can talk on behalf of the KWS board there, more than happy to actually have a look at what opportunities there are to actually work in that space.
Thank you.
And the final one, the Latin American Cultural Association of Tasmania, that's a really exciting festival proposal that the Mayor and I actually met with the applicant and encouraged her to apply for a grant. We hadn't had any follow-up conversations, noting that it's 1,600 partially funded. Have we at all followed up with the applicant to ensure that this great event for Kingborough will go ahead?
Dr. Stevenson.
Through you, Mayor. We can't follow up with the applicants until Council contemplates the grants, so this is a dilemma of the process. We actually need a Council endorsement and then we have the conversations. But to explain the decision-making on this one, the grant was request was specifically linked to audiovisual support. They did not know that we have all that equipment within the hub, so they had based it on a quote from Alive Technologies, and so what we calculated was the equivalent of hiring it from us, which is a lot less, plus the hiring of the hub, and so that's how we came up with that grant amount. So it should enable them to achieve exactly the same outcome. It's just not using the external AV support, but rather using the equipment that we have.
Great. Fantastic. Thank you.
Councillor Cordova.
Thank you, Mayor. Briefly, I would like to extend my congratulations to really all of these organisations, and it speaks volumes about the amazing work that community groups do in our municipality, and I'm truly thankful for all that they do and how they bring us all together. Bruni Bowls Club, the Kingston Community Garden, the Ratepayers Association, Kingston Beach Sailing, Woodbridge Life 2022 events, Taruna Football Club and the Latin American Cultural Association of Tasmania. I have raised it before, and it's a good opportunity to raise it again, that I think we need to broaden our criteria so that the matched funding and the operational in nature doesn't always have to be a hurdle it doesn't always have to be an obstacle, rather. Let it be a hurdle, but not an obstacle, because I think it's hard to explain to people in the community that, you know, for example, the West Winds, well, they didn't have the matched funding. Well, what is the purpose and intention behind the matched funding criteria? Well, it's obviously, you know, you want organisations to show goodwill. You don't want people just coming up with a harebrained idea and then getting money for it. But in the case of West Winds, they've done an enormous amount of work for a very long time. So why is it that we need the matched funding arrangements in those cases? Another example would be, you know, the argument about they need to have nothing that's just benefiting a school. Well, you know, the argument that this only benefits school kids, but those school kids live in the municipality, and by them knowing more about food waste and organics, I mean, that will be a huge benefit to all of us. Similarly with the Friends of the Library, yes, I understand the library state government, but also if it's the library in our neighbourhood, it's benefiting our neighbourhood. So I think we need to really massage and tease out what it is that the intention is behind that criteria of deliberately providing absolute barriers when it comes to matched funding and operational in nature. Once again, I want to congratulate everybody involved and thank the staff so much for the amazing work that they do. And I really do understand why this can't just be an open floodgate of pouring money out. I understand that. But I also think that time again, I see some really great programs, inclusive kids, provision of sensory-friendly children's programs at Kingston Library. That would be fantastic. And I hope that the state government funds it and that the library funds it or that the Margate Primary School is able to get Department of Education funding. But what if they can't? That means that we miss out on these great projects. I feel like we're missing out on good projects because of a criteria that is needlessly constrained. I would like a bit more flexibility the next time we look at the policy parameters in this area. But thank you once again and congratulations to all those involved. It's a fantastic program and I hope it continues.
Thank you. Any further speakers? If not, I will put the motion as moved by Councillor Fox and seconded by Councillor Street. All those in favour? Against? Motion is carried unanimously. Moving on now to the financial report for September 2021 with a recommendation on page 272. Do I have a mover and a seconder, please? Move Councillor Westwood, seconded Councillor Fox. Councillor Westwood.
Thank you. This is our financial report for September 2021. It shows an forecast underlying deficit for 2021-22 of $393,000. Still early in the financial year, I guess. A few things have changed since we did put our budget together in June. I had one question just in relation to statutory fees and fines are $61,000 over budget, primarily due to recovered legal fees. Just to check, so when you say recovered, we have actually received the money back from those outstanding cases.
Mr. Breen.
Yes, through you, Mayor, yes. We don't recognise the income until we actually receive the funds.
Okay, thank you. That's all from me.
Any further questions for Mr. Breen? Oh, good, because we've made him sit here all this time and I think he deserves more than one question. Councillor Cordo.
Thank you, Mayor. Contributions, cash is $226,000 over budget due to the contribution to public open space of $207,000 from the Spring Farm subdivision. Can we just get a bit more detail about how that transpired? And, yeah, thanks.
Mr. Breen.
Yeah, through you, Mayor. Look, essentially, my understanding is the Spring Farm developers were going to build a path. They obviously investigated that, and in the end, they came to the conclusion that it was going to be perhaps more of a significant job than they expected. So they've transferred the funds to Council, who are now looking at their options in regards to building a path.
Thank you. And a follow-up question. So am I right to assume, therefore, that the whilst we've received a contribution to public open space over and above what we'd budgeted for, but we'll also be... there will be a deficit, a corresponding deficit of the same amount elsewhere because we now have to pay for this thing that we thought that they were going to pay for, and is that more or less than what we expected?
Mr. Reeve.
Through you, Mayor. So we would need to go through the process of actually determining the exact cost of actually building the path. So they've provided a contribution. However, it may be likely that the cost could be slightly higher, in which case we would then need to be actually covering those costs there. So we would actually be looking at utilising that funds, as public open space funds there. But if it becomes to be something which is dearer than that, we'd also be looking at actually trying to get additional funds to actually pay for that as well at the same time.
Thank you. So are we better or worse off, if I'm correct hearing, am I correct that we are worse off as a result of this financially?
Mr. Breen.
Mr.
Reeve, sorry. Yeah. It's getting late, isn't it?
I've always wanted to be Mr. Breen. Through you, Mayor. Look, at this stage here, we're just finalising the designs of it. We've got the design plans off the developer there, and we're looking at that at the moment there. Our best guess estimate that it will probably be higher than what they've provided for us in open space funding.
Thank you. And can I please have a sense of how much we are put out? A ballpark, even just an order of magnitude, what kind of it?
Mr. Breen, Mr. Smee.
Thank you, Mayor. The cost of doing the track has been calculated at $475,000, and the cost of the connection track through the council land is $125,000. We have submitted a grant application today for the $600,000 required to undertake both those sections of track, using the $207,000 contribution from the Jack Group as council's contribution to that grant fund. There was a requirement for council to put in a minimum of 20%. So that's what we have done today.
Thank you, that's really helpful, and I'm not a math surgeon, but I work it out to be $393,000 worse off than I think we anticipated we would be. So whilst it looks like, you know, cash is over budget because we've got this contribution, the way I see it, it's actually going to cost $600,000, so we're out of pocket $393,000. In light of that, what lessons have we learnt, if any, from this experience?
Dr. Stevenson.
Through you, Mayor. I'll have a go at this. the intent is we can only proceed with the work either through a capital bid project in the next budget or if we're successful with the grant. So in that sense, talking about winning and losing at this stage doesn't have any relevance because it's just the open space contribution that we're entitled to that we've received earlier. We would have not seen it on the books if they had done the work, but we might well have been expected to contribute to get the design that we wanted, and that was where things sort of fell apart. We wanted something more than they were prepared to give.
Thank you. Is there a chance that design work would have cost $393,000? My guess would be it would be a lot less than that $393,000.
Can I just clarify, what do you mean the design?
Well, so the work that we anticipated doing, if I'm understanding correctly, there was always going to be a component that council would end up paying for. But what I've heard...
I think what you're missing is that the complexity of the design has got...
Yeah.
Because of the location of the path, the complexity has increased substantially. And so it's not just about the design work that's going to cost more, but the actual build of it as well.
Yeah. Thank you.
Mr. Smee.
Thank you, Mayor. I think the Jack Group only ever proposed to do as much work as they were required to fund through public open space funds. So they never got to the point that we know of where they had fully costed the work that was to be done. So any shortfall, it was always the intent that council would need to meet that shortfall, particularly the section through the council-owned land that the Jack Group had never committed to. They only ever committed to doing the work within the Spring Farm estate. They did all the design work for that. Those plans were provided to council at no cost. But there was never an intent on their behalf that the whole track would be done by them. It was only the intent to do as much work as they were required to fund with the equivalent public open space funds.
Thank you. And so I guess at the end of all this, will there be a point at which we can evaluate how it all went? I'm getting from the sense of what's just been said that it's not accurate to say that council is either better or worse off because we wouldn't have known how much we had to put in. But will there be a time that we will get a sense in the evaluation of whether this could have been done better or whether we could have expected more from the proponent? And the reason I ask is because there's significant community interest, and you can understand how it feels from the outside looking in that it kind of looks like we've been left in the lurch by a developer.
Through you, Mayor. We don't have any power. We don't have any ability to leverage additional funding outside the public open space funding. So we could never expect that they would fund more than they are required. We certainly couldn't compel. And it would be an unusual developer that would volunteer to give up a significant profit amount of a few hundred thousand. So I think the assumption was always it was going to be a partnership. The advantage, I mean, I think the original, recommendation was that we took the public open space funding and did it ourselves, and they were keen to make use of their contractors and thought they could do it. And then as the design work was done, and it is a complex site, it has, you know, steep gradients, it has water flooding issues and all sorts of things. So I think then once the design work was done, then it was realised it was beyond their required amount of input.
Okay, Councillor Bastone.
Thank you. I'll be as brief as I can. Earlier, probably a month, 6 weeks ago, we had an artist putting little crosses up Somersley Road for wherever there were dead animals. And I looked at the dead animal removal costs, and they've doubled on what we estimated. Is this because of Somersley Road, or are we just being extra vigilant in getting rid of our dead animals now?
Mm. Now, should this be Mr. Breen or Mr. Reeve? I can't decide. I reckon Mr. Reeve.
Through you, Mayor. I can give a bit of a general answer, but I think I'd probably need to get some more information from the depot in terms of what they may have actually got in the last periods in terms of dead animals there. But it's certainly not necessarily to do with, well, in fact, it's not to do with Somersley Road at all. It would only be across the board for any dead animals that we're picking up in different locations. So most of the ones we're actually dealing with are in an urban location as compared to a more of a rural location. But I wouldn't know off the top of my head exactly why that one's up. It could be just a timing thing. It could be there's just been an influx of animals just to do with the weather conditions or whatever it happens to be, but I'd be only guessing, so I can provide some more information back there.
Thank you. Are there any further contributions? If not, I will put the motion that Council endorses the attached financial report at the 30th of September 2021. Moved by Councillor Westwood, seconded by Councillor Fox. All those in favour?
Aye.
Against? Motion is carried unanimously. We now move into closed session. The confirmation of items to be dealt with in closed session. That in accordance with Regulation 15 of the Local Government Meeting Procedures Regulations 2015, Council by absolute majority move into closed session to consider the following items: confirmation of minutes and applications for leave of absence. Do I have a mover and a seconder, please? Councillor Cordova and Councillor Midgley. All those in favour? Those against? Motion is carried unanimously. In accordance with the Kingborough Council meeting's audio recording guidelines policy, recording of the open session of the meeting will now cease. Open session of Council adjourned at 8:59 p.m.